Good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, December 4th, 2017. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 515-604-9386. Our participant code is 416-303. If your cell provider blocks or charges for the call, you can call our backup number, 781-838-3728. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is going to be Matthew chapter 21. We're picking up where we left off. We ended in chapter 20. So we're going to start in chapter 21 and read 16 verses, 1 through 16. And when they drew near unto Jerusalem and will come to Bethpage, unto the Mount of Olives, then sent Jesus two disciples, saying unto them, Go into the village over against you, and straightway you shall find an ass tied and a colt with her. Loose them, and bring them unto me. And if any man say aught unto you, you shall say, The Lord hath need of them, and straightway he will send them. And this was done, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the prophet, saying, Tell ye the daughters of Zion, Behold, thy king cometh unto thee, meek, and sitting upon an ass, and a colt, the foal of an ass. And the disciples went and did as Jesus commanded them, and brought the ass and the colt, and put on them their clothes, and they set him upon them thereon. And a very great multitude spread their garments in the way. Others cut down branches from the trees and strewed them in the way. And the multitudes that went before and that followed cried, saying, Hosanna to the Son of David. Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Hosanna in the highest. And when he was come unto Jerusalem, all the city was moved, saying, Who is this? And the multitude said, This is Jesus, the prophet of Nazareth of Galilee. And Jesus went into the temple of God, and cast out all of them that sold and bought in the temple, and overthrew the tables of the money changers, and the seats of them that sold doves, and said unto them, It is written, My house shall be called the house of prayer, but ye have made it a den of thieves. And the blind and the lame came to him in the temple, and he healed them. And when the chief priests and the scribes saw the wonderful things that he did, and the children crying in the temple and saying, Hosanna to the Son of David, they were sore displeased, and said unto him, Hearest thou what these say? And Jesus saith unto them, Yea, have ye never read out of the mouth of babes and sucklings thou hast perfected praise? Okay, that was Matthew chapter 21, verses 1 through 16. Okay, we're going to talk some more tonight, at least a little bit, about our Sheriff's Project. Website is up and going. We did send an email out today, so we're hoping that all of our members, we're going to try to get the word out to all of our members to get over to this new website. It's powerofthecountysheriff.com. .org, I'm sorry. powerofthecountysheriff.org. Everybody should get out there and, sign up. It's free to sign up, but we do ask during the sign-up process if you can afford to give a donation for this project. We ask people, again, $5 a month or more, or a one-time gift. We make the point that we have over 6,000 members. We're looking to collect about $60,000. And then, of course, after that, we're hoping to have enough membership to maintain the cost of the website and also send out more of the sheriff's handbooks. There'll be some sheriffs, I'm sure, that will be asking for more because they have more than 20 sheriffs, but 20 should cover most of the sheriff's uh, and across the nation, I think. But again, there are larger sheriff departments in certain areas than there are in others, and they may require more than 20. So upon request, we'll fill those orders for those who want more. So that'll kind of cost additional costs as time goes on. We also would like to start sending these sheriff's handbooks out also to other individuals that are elected, because everyone should know the law. We may even create another handbook and call it, I don't want to call it the politician's handbook, but, look at any servant, a handbook for political servants or something. I don't know. We'll have to think about that. But we might do something like that, which would be pretty much the same as the sheriff's handbook, but it would be directed towards anybody who is holding elected office. So we'll think about that. But the sheriff's handbook on its own is good for anybody, okay? But, of course, it was designed very specifically for the sheriff. We do have I think we'll call it close to the final draft. We did get some other ideas from another individual or two that we may incorporate in here, maybe some corrections that we may incorporate in here. I'm not sure yet. I'd have to go through that. But we still have another couple of weeks, to try to tie all that together so we can get the final print done. I did get an estimate, and then I got a second estimate today. And it's close to 50 cents at this point per book, our cost. Close to it, not quite, but close to it. And we're 128 pages. I don't think we can really shave much down. But every 8 to 16 pages we shave off of there, we'd save a little piece of money. But again, it's not even worth it when we consider the amount we'd save versus the importance of the message. So I think we're going to end up with 128 pages, sheriff's handbook. And again, I've run an estimate of approximately $60,000 for the entire project. So again, going back to people signing up, if every one of our members were to give $10, and let's say 6,000 members joined, which I don't expect that to happen, but, if that did happen, right there is $60,000, 10 bucks a piece. But, if everybody comes in and gives maybe $5 a month or more, in 2 months we have the money. But nevertheless, we're going to be going out to other Liberty groups. We've got a few other things and ideas on how we might be able to earn money for this project. But again, the project's going to cost us $60,000 to have these 80,000 sheriff's handbooks printed up, delivered, and then repackaged, 20 in a package, and sent to 3,000 plus, sheriffs. Also, what we're going to do is we're offering anybody who is donating $10 a month or more, we'll send them a free handbook. Anybody who donates a one-time offer, $50 or more. I think it's $50 or more that we got written up. Anybody who donates $50 or more, not a month, but a one-time donation, we'll send them a handbook, a free handbook. In order to get that handbook, though, you'll need to send, and we wrote this information down on the website, you'll have to send us, mail us your physical mailing address where we would mail this book. So if anybody donates, over $10 a month or more, or over $50, and if they don't send us their address, then we're not going to know where to send it, and obviously you won't get a handbook. But anyway, hopefully that will encourage people to do this. At some point in time, we might even sell these handbooks. I was out online looking at handbooks and what people are selling them for. It was one individual who went out and pre-done our books, and we had written it on the jurist handbooks, and they were selling it, making money at $5 a piece. And there are other people selling different kinds of handbooks, that are pocket handbooks for different things, and they were selling them between $5 and $20 a piece. So I'm thinking maybe we might sell them $5 a piece. Or we may sell maybe a large quantity for a lot better price. I don't know. That's something we'll consider doing after we get all of the sheriffs their handbooks. And then we will have quite a few left over at that point, and I think about 20,000 or something. And we do want to get them into the hands of people. And again, additional cop books going out to sheriffs who need them. We'd like to get, of course, a copy up to President Trump and Jeff Sessions and numerous other people. We need to move on this. So look at an extremely important program. I know I saw an email come through that the, I think it's the Welcoming Committee, is meeting, I think, tomorrow. I could be corrected on that, but I think they're meeting tomorrow. Who's running the Welcoming Committee? Are they here? I don't see Jan in, so Jan's not here. Terry, do you know if who's running the Welcoming Committee and if there's a meeting tomorrow?
There is a meeting tomorrow, and I'll look up my email and find it for you, but I thought Robert was doing it.
Robert? Okay. And it was the Welcoming Committee, right?
It was addressed from Rhonda. I don't know if Rhonda Miner's running it or... That's who sent the email.
All right, well, let's try to find out, and we'll let everybody know as soon as we know. Meanwhile, let me continue. So anyway, we are working, bringing the Welcoming Committee to work with other leadership and also anybody else who wants to participate to start a phone call project for the sheriff's project, shall I say. So we're going to want to call people up. I have not been able to put together, I just haven't had time, I haven't thought about it recently, but I have to think about it now, a dialogue, you know. We'll create a very short dialogue. It shouldn't take long, maybe less than a minute, maybe even less than 30 seconds, I don't know. But we're going to make a very short dialogue, which we'll call all of our members, and ask them to visit the site and strongly consider either joining up and giving a monthly donation if they can, or join up and then hopefully maybe give us a one-time donation. But look it, we need to try to get this as quick as possible so we could do the whole project in one shot. If we can't collect this kind of money quick enough and it starts to really drag on and we're months into the game, so to speak, and we don't have enough money to purchase all of these, we're going to end up purchasing maybe half or even a quarter of the amount for a much, much more expensive rate, much more expensive. And so then this project on the long run may cost us, instead of $60,000, maybe $70,000, maybe more. I don't know. I haven't figured all that math out. But it definitely will cost us substantially more. But at least then we can start the project and start getting these things out to sheriffs at some point. We don't want to sit on money waiting for 3 months, 6 months, or whatever, and just waiting to hit that goal to be able to go do something. We do want to do something as soon as possible. So, but hopefully, again, hopefully we'll be able to reach out through our membership alone and collect enough monies. Also, we're going to be talking with training people also to talk to others. And again, in that dialogue that we would have when we make these calls, not only ask them to go out to the website, read the front page, read the sheriff's book, and consider a donation, but also, get the message out to your liberty groups. Get your liberty groups out there. Let them read the website, particularly the first page, and also read the sheriff's handbook to see how powerful it is. And hopefully we'll get a lot of people through other liberty groups that haven't heard of us and maybe come out and work with this project. Now, again, the website is powerofthecountysheriff.com. .org. powerofthecountysheriff.org. That is the website. So everybody needs to get out there as soon as possible, sign up, and get things moving. Let's see. I don't know that there's much more to say about this other than we got to get moving. And again, we'll create that dialogue and we'll also train everybody in that dialogue on what needs to be said. We're going to ask people to give a commitment. And we're also going to ask the people calling if they can maybe call 5 or 10 people a week for us, or more. Some people can spend some time, do it for a few hours here and a few hours there, and get quite a few calls out. But others, maybe if they can do 5 calls a week or 10 calls a week, just get the message out to these individuals to get out, take a look at the website, consider, participating and helping us to get the message out so that we can educate our sheriffs, because that is a key. You know, Donald Trump's doing some amazing things. I don't know if anybody heard the speech that he gave out there in Utah. And I think the speech was today, but it could have been over the weekend. I know it was uploaded today, so I'm not sure when this speech was put out there. But if you go out to our website, powerofthecountysheriff.com, and highlight news, let's see, I think it's on the news page, as it is, click on news. And yeah, you'll see the very first video breaking. President Donald Trump gives historic speech, okay? This is probably one of the most important speeches that Trump has really given to the people, in my opinion. And the reason I say that is because he goes after, without mentioning names, he's going after the BLM, he's going after the FBI, and there's no doubt in my mind that's why all of these people were released out there, because he's going to go after the judicial process, after these judges, this particularly that judge belongs in jail out there. But in any event, they got word, and that's what's happening. He talked about how the federal government has really robbed the states by taking control of this land, and it belongs to the states. And he signed a proclamation concerning this land, and that it does belong in the states, the hands of the states, and it belongs in the hands of the people who have these agreements and have taken care of the land either cattling or mining or whatever it is that they're doing, logging. All of this is for America and not for the federal government. So if you haven't heard this speech, you got to go hear it. It's not that long a speech. I think it's maybe about 20 minutes long. In the beginning, I think it starts right away, but in the end, there's a signing of the proclamation and all that stuff, which takes up quite a bit of time. So I think the speech is less than 20 minutes. But a pretty darn good speech. I think it was pretty powerful and probably one of the most important ones at this point in time because of what it's doing. On our news page, we actually have three news pages. We have just regular news. Then we have news, Constitution, and Jeopardy. And then we have news for sheriffs and the Constitution. Everybody might want to watch some of those videos if you haven't seen these videos, especially the Constitution in Jeopardy page. And, of course, the news, which is basically what's going on. And there's about, there are 6 videos up here, and I think they're all great videos and very informative, give a lot of information. So anyway, that's what's out there. Getting back to our project, Trump can only do so much, and he can win back a lot, and he certainly is doing so. I've also heard from so many different sources, but we haven't seen any evidence of this yet. 5,000 plus sealed indictments, and I understand that's worldwide. Okay, it's not just in America, but we're going after people outside of America is the point. But in any event, a lot of these indictments are from within our government, people within our government. 5,000, that's a lot of indictments, if that's true. I don't want to say that it's absolutely true, but I've been hearing this for 2 weeks now, and I keep hearing it from different sources. I don't know if everybody is just mimicking what other people are saying. We do want to be a little careful with that message. But it's going to be very, very interesting if this is the truth. I'm sure there are some indictments at least, but again, I'm hearing 5,000 at this point, over 5,000. But even with that, remember, Trump could make some changes and he could do a lot of stuff and turn things around, but if we don't take out the garbage, if we don't finish getting rid of all these creatures at the bottom of the swamp, and we don't complete the job by taking control of our judiciary, Not bringing them back to the courts of justice without the people, because it'll only slip right back to where it started, where we just came from. Okay? The people need to get in control and keep their liberty. Only the people can maintain their liberty. Only the people can save America. If the people expect to be ignorant and free, it's not going to happen. I'm very disappointed, often when I talk to people and I tell them they should go learn about this or that, and especially people who might have a little legal problem here or there, and I tell them, go do it yourself. Yeah, it's too much for them. They need a lawyer. You know, look, we're making ourselves invalids, you know. We're making ourselves as children and having to go to have someone else represent us. People should learn this in school. I've mentioned this before, and at some point in time, that'll be one of our projects, is to make sure that we get a good education in civics and on the Constitution and how the court system works. It's very, very simple. This does not have to be complex. And really, look at it, when you're looking at the common law, it's so interesting looking at these different things and history and what is liberty and what our unalienable rights are and some of these decisions of the Supreme Court. You know, this is so fascinating and interesting as you're looking into these things. And this is what your liberty is resting upon, your knowledge of the law. And if you don't, and the law, again, is the law of the Creator, the Creator's law, ultimately. Yes, statutes come to play. Most of them are illegal, but the ones that are legal are very important. Read your Constitution and look at the powers we gave Congress in Article 1 and run down the list and see what powers of control and the ability to write laws that they have, and you'll understand and see how important it is that Congress does write statutes for these particular issues found in Article 1. And it's important that we understand them. And it's important so that we know how to battle a court case, whether it be in an equity court or in a court of justice. Both of them should be courts of justice, or should I say, an equity court or a court of law, as the Constitution puts it in Article 3. We can't expect one man to save America. The job is far from over, and no matter what occurs over the course of the next 6 months or so, I'm hearing things about pedophilia rings worldwide going down. I heard, I heard some things and thoughts about a speech that the president had given, and he grabbed a bottle of water. And goodness, what was that, Gerard? Was that something with an F?
It was the Fuji water. He held the container. They made a big deal that he took a drink in the middle of the speech. And then he held both hands on the bottle with the label forward. Well, Fuji is one of the operators that have been in the Clinton Foundation that's deep into the child pedophilia, which, by the way, is bigger business right now than drugs are. And a lot of those indictments are them taking the rat lines that they use to traffic these drugs and these children. And so that's why you have so many, because he's going after even the operators that facilitate this. But yeah, that was Fuji Water,
okay,
big supporter and operator.
All right. So again, he's going after these groups. He seems to be taking them down. He seems to have a really good plan. Clearly, he knows what's going on. He understands. Clearly, he knows what's going on out west. And by the way, on our newspaper, on our news pages, if you click on Constitution in Jeopardy. Okay, the very, very, very first video you're going to see there is why Lavoie Finicken was assassinated. I'm thinking of really moving that speech by the president maybe above this video and then have this video as second. But right now, the other one's on the news, and this one is on, news concerning the Constitution being in jeopardy. So anyway, he can make a lot of fixes, and he can send them back 50 years or 20 years or whatever. But if we don't, get rid of the cancer, if we don't take control of our government by consenting, either through the jury boxes or through the ballot boxes, or, and most importantly, other than the jury boxes, that's extremely important, but also through the committeemen, the committees of safety, which will morph into back into the committeemen, just like they did in the beginning of our nation. That's how the committeemen came into being. So unless the people take control of that, the political process and the judiciary process, we're going to lose it again. It's only a matter of time. We got to get rid of these beasts. So, okay, let's see. Let me see if...
I got Robert has something to say, too, so...
All right, let me see if Jan's here first. Jan, are you here? Is he back?
Jan is not going to be here.
Not going to be here tonight. Okay. All right, let's go over to Robert first.
I've got his questions, though.
Okay, great. Go ahead. You go. You got the mic.
All right. Let me find them here real quick. Okay. This is a multi-part question. John said MLA was making a new juror's handbook. Does MLA have any old juror's handbooks? If so, how do I order?
Okay. I do have some, not many, a couple of hundred at most, and I do have some requests. I have a sheriff that requested a bunch. I'm going to send it out to him. And they're not really up for sale at this point. I mean, if someone really wanted one, and if I start to get a lot of people want one, I just can't keep up on that. But, you know, if someone wanted one, I could probably get it out to someone. But, you know, we will be – I want to rewrite that book, okay? The book – I want to take the sheriff's book and a lot of stuff in the sheriff's book and, you know, sort of meld it into the jurist handbook. But we do want to direct it to the jurist on the one hand and then the sheriff to the sheriff. And then I'd like to get a third handbook and direct it to all elected and appointed officials. What's necessary for them what they really need to know in order to run for office, you know? I mean, and they need to take their oath serious. And again, that's what these books are going to be focused in on. Sheriff's Handbook, I'm really happy to say I believe we've done a good job on this handbook. I really think we've got everything we want. Someone did point a few little points out that we may not have covered, and I got to go through that to see to make sure that is the case. And so we might add a little more, but not much. I would think maybe just a couple paragraphs and maybe a correction or two here or there, but I got to go through those notes. So, but no, at this point, there really is nothing available. Again, you know, money is the problem. You know, if people were giving if we had enough people giving on a regular basis, you know, we'd be able to buy a lot more handbooks and get them published and start selling them, and that would, again, help to make more money, you know, sell them with a profit. But we can sell them cheap. I know we were selling 100 jurist handbooks, a box of 100. We were selling them, I think, for $68, and that included delivery, you know, everything. You know, $68, and we delivered it anywhere in the nation, anywhere in the 50 states. I think Hawaii was a little bit of a problem, but I think we were getting that cheap through bulk mail, the way we were mailing it, and so it wasn't too big a deal. But it does get expensive when you're mailing a package out to Hawaii or Alaska. So I'd like to get back to that and sell them in the quantities, and I'd like to be able to sell the sheriff's handbooks in quantities. You know, one of the things we're going to do, we need to get to the jurist handbooks again, because once we take control, we're going to need, you know, handbooks in the hands of all the jurists, whether they're grand jury or a trial jury. We need to get these books into their hands, something for them to walk away with, keep in their pocket, and refer to, you know. We want to make it a good reference book, just like we did for the sheriff. So we do want to get those books up and going, and we want to keep the price down, you know. For instance, you know, when the juries, the administrators start ordering them for their county, and again, you know, you'll get a budget. And we'll talk about all those things once we get in, how we work out the budget and the different accounts necessary for paying and where the money would come from and all that other stuff, but we're not going to get into that discussion now. But there will be a budget for handbooks, there'll be a budget for a website and you know, and an education, and collectively we could make this extremely cheap, and National Liberty Alliance will remain as a facilitator for education and information. We'll continue on that level to make sure we provide a good education. We might even do a very specific, we're writing a handbook, another handbook, for the administrator's handbook, how things work, you know. And so they'd be able to refer to the handbook to get things going in their counties. You know, we'll fumble along a little bit as we go along, but even with the fumbling, we'll do 100 times better than the system that's in there now, because at least we'll bring justice into the game. So we do want to get the books out. We want to get them out cheaply, and we want to get them out everywhere. We also would like to get a program going at some time in the future, you know, once we move back into the committee man process and get the people back in control of that on the grassroots level. And again, that we're doing that through the committees of safety. Once they get in and start, and the people take back the control of the committee man process, then we'd like to really get books out to those people, so that they can go out to the people in their election districts and get these books into the hands of everybody, all the people, and start working an educational program that needs to be put into the schools for our children. So, you know, there's a lot to do. We have a lot of things to do. We're not going to run out of work, that's for sure. But but right now, our big focus is the Sheriff's Project. This is one of the most important things. And, of course, continuing what we're doing in the courts, you know, that's without saying. We're not going to stop that. But we want to get this Sheriff's Project off the ground. So, please, everybody, hit the ground running on this, and let's get our volunteers and start phone calling. I'll try to make it to tomorrow's evening and tomorrow evening's meeting. And also I'll try to get a, you know, some kind of a dialogue for the phone, you know, what we would cover. And it'll be very simple, easy to remember. It's going to be very easy, simple stuff. Okay, there was a second part to that question? So right now the books are not really available. So.
Okay, the next part to that. Does the defendant or his attorney have to have the judge's permission to distribute these handbooks to a sitting jury? If the judge refuses, can they be distributed to the jury pool during jury selection?
Well, look, at trying to get one of these booklets into the court filled with lawyers is like bringing, what would you say, a cross into a vampire's, you know, parlor. I don't know. They will do everything to get rid of you. We're not going to have any success going that route. I don't want to see anyone get into trouble or get arrested or any of that things. But once we, the people, take control on it, they're going to get it right when they come in to get orientation. We're going to give them a copy of that book free of charge. We need to. Each jurist needs to have a handbook. And we also need to give an orientation, which we have most of that already planned out. We have to kind of shore that up, and we'll list it out in the handbook, for the administrator's handbook, what we propose as an orientation program in different videos, which we'll make available that could be downloaded for the juries to watch. And of course, the people are free to add other things that they think is appropriate. Again, this is grassroots control. National Liberty Alliance has no real control other than an advisory level to the people. And we will make certain things we will strongly suggest. In the beginning, we'll try to keep, you know, hold on the reins as tight as possible for as long as possible, but working with the membership of National Liberty Alliance to prevent people from coming in to subvert. But once we balance out there, and then it's going to be really totally up to the people on the grassroots level to maintain their integrity, to maintain their oaths to God and their vows to God, and to make sure that they bring the message to the people, you know, concerning the Constitution, concerning the law of the land, concerning what is just, what is a just court, and who is the king of the court. And again, we will lay it all out. People will have to do it. This is the great American experiment, so to speak. As I think it was Franklin said, that only morally minded people are going to be able to do this. You know, that's why liberty is frightening to some people. You know, oh, you can't not allow the cops to give tickets for speeding or for this or for that. Well, it is a little frightening. But you know what? People generally do the right thing. People just don't go around and, get into chaos and create chaos because no one's there to restrain them. Look, we learned that as children, to be somewhat restrained. Maybe not so much these days with the way schools are going, but we need to get back to discipline of our children. But, people are social in being. They're social. And therefore, we're going to be yielding to each other as we go through life. I do all the time yield to people in life, and I see people yield to me, whether I'm in a car or walking in the street or walking in a store, holding a door for someone, and, whatever the case may be, and they for me, helping someone out. This is just doing the right thing, and that's normal society. It just works on its own. We do have videos on this. As a matter of fact, we did post this on the website for our sheriff's website. I'm trying to see where we put it. Let's see. I think we put it under Sheriff and the Constitution, and I think it's all the way down towards the bottom. Let me see if it's here. Yes, it is. The last two videos on that page really takes, for instance, traffic control, the road to nowhere. If you haven't seen that video, you need to go out and see that video. It just blows your mind, okay? It's going to blow you away. And Stossel's report on spontaneous order. I don't know if it says Porter, P-R or D-E-R. I don't know. Someone made a mistake right here. But anyway, spontaneous order. Very, very impressive news report on that. So anyway, it can work. People have to have faith in it. And again, as long as we're reasonably morally minded people, if we train up our children the way they should walk, get a proper education for our children in school, require the discipline. And, people are going to have to work that out, how schools can discipline, and we as parents need to discipline. We could make it. But it's not easy to really have true liberty. It takes work and yielding one to another. All right. Where else are we here? I think I carried away.
Okay. Can government employees take the Fifth since they have taken an oath to obey, protect, and defend the Constitution? However, compensated government employees cannot refuse to report to the people when required. In other words, they must resign if they take the Fifth.
Yeah, as far as an employee is concerned, if they're employed, if they're not elected or appointed, but they're just an employee, if they have a responsible position, okay, of authority, and they have to answer to people concerning their authority, you would think if someone refused to answer concerning their authority at that level, they would be fired. It's almost impossible, I hear, to fire a government employee. But we got to change that around. People need to be fired. That's just to begin with. But when we get to the real levels where the real things are really important, like the elected individuals, the appointed individuals, people who are going before Congress, okay, they can't call for the right to remain silent. They've got certain powers and authorities that was vested in them in that position that they have taken, and it is their job and their duty to report to those who call them for giving an accounting. And so if Congress calls you to give an accounting of your job, your work, what you're doing, and report and give all the information to them, then you need to do that. And if you don't do that, then these people would be in bad behavior. The United States Supreme Court has ruled anyone who has a duty to speak and remain silent is guilty of fraud. Okay? That's what fraud. So right there, we get rid of them for fraud, and they shouldn't have their jobs no longer. They should be removed from that position immediately and fired, literally. They should no longer be employed by the government. And then the person, their underling, the next person under, would need to come up, gather together the wreckage, review all things, and come and give a report. They can't not give the report. Although they get away with it, and I don't know why some of these congressmen that they should know better, but they don't know this simple, principle. Silence when you have a duty to speak is fraud. So no, they can't do it. But again, an employee, I don't know that's, again, if they're in a position of authority and power, even though they're an employee and they're not appointed, but they do get into that position of power, I'm not sure how that would work and why they'd be even required to do anything on that level anyway. So.
Well, some employees take oaths, John, like police officers. They take an oath to the Constitution.
Well, that's true. Okay.
So they got a duty.
Yeah, if there's an oath there, they got a duty. You're absolutely right. But all employees for the government don't take oaths, do they? Maybe they do. I don't know.
No, we need to
find out.
No, they don't all take. Look at the janitor at the town hall doesn't take an oath. Okay, he's just an employee. Your groundsman and all that, they're just employees. The reason that you have police officers taking oaths is because they're upholding the law. And so, like you said, those people who have a duty to speak, they usually have a certain authority. And
right.
So, and those are the people we're talking about.
Well, in that case, if they've took an oath and they have a duty to speak, they can't plead the fifth when it comes to their work, that they've been given and meted out certain authority to exercise that authority and produce whatever records are required of them produced. They can't hold them back. They can't reject. They can't deny. They can't do any of that. They should be immediately removed, fired, gone, and even considered further action beyond that, in my opinion.
You know, an employee who has a position of supervisory and spends a budget, he has a duty to speak. And if he doesn't speak, that could be considered fraud. Although, I don't know how you can hold him to that exactly. I mean, he'd have to quit, for one thing, because that means he doesn't want to incriminate himself, which is almost like if he takes the fifth, you automatically consider him guilty, which you're not supposed to do when they take the fifth. But I would say somebody that has control of money, even if he doesn't have an oath, and they ask him to make an accounting and he refuses, number one, that's immediate dismissal, but it's also fraud. And so I don't know how you pursue that, but that's a kind of a sticky one there.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, yeah, absolutely. We'd have to think about how we can proceed there, but because apparently they haven't been and they're not. I mean, I just can't believe Congress allowing people coming up there to give an accounting, and we're talking about people who are in positions that are appointed. Okay, they're up there to give an accounting, and they don't want to give a certain information. I don't know how Congress lets them get away with it. So we need to think some more about that, on how to deal with that problem. But definitely they should lose their jobs. Definitely the next person underneath them needs to collect themselves, go through all the things that they don't know about, and then come up and answer on behalf. And then you'll probably find out that the person before them was breaking the law, or they were trying to cover up for someone else who was breaking the law. That's probably why they don't want to talk. But anyway, Robert?
That's all the questions. However, I do have a report on Nevada.
Okay.
Now, there's no court this week. However, last week they decided to release the four defendants that were on trial, and they did. However, Cliven Bundy refused to leave his cell until all other defendants were released. And so today, I believe it was four more were released. And so, they gave in to him. Now, my understanding is that this trial will go on, but what happened to get for all these people to be released, the judge changing her mind and releasing them, was that Ryan Bundy and Cliven's attorney, Whipple, what they did is they proved to the judge beyond any shadow of a doubt that the government's case was based on all lies and deceit. And so I can't believe that this trial, they say they're going to have some meetings and stuff. I got a feeling maybe this trial is over.
I think you know, the president's involved here at this point. They know it. Look, he went all the way out to Utah to give a speech concerning the problems with the BLM and the FBI and the right of the people of the property that they have contracts on. Again, if anybody hasn't
right.
seen that speech, you guys, you got to get out and listen to this speech. And
we're
going to get our sheriffs out there, too. You know, we're going to get them thinking and talking like this. And the only way we're going to get that done is by the sheriff's project. Go ahead, Robert.
Well, also, in his speech in Utah, he rescinded what Obama did as far as the monuments. There were 1.5 million acres in the monument, and he reduced that back down to 220,000. So that's, he rescinded a bunch, and he's also rescinding some of what Bill Clinton designated. And what I don't know is whether he realizes, and I think he probably does, but that Obama was designating monuments as a way to turn over control to the UN. Mm. And I wonder if that might make his decision on rescinding more even more likely.
Hmm.
So,
yeah, it's an interesting point.
But I have to believe that's what's happening in this trial now will have an effect on the trials that were in Portland, because a lot of what happened in the trials in Portland are based on different things that started in at the Bundy Ranch standoff. So I think there's a lot going to happen in the future, like more people arrested, more BLM people in trouble. I got to believe there's going to be some more arrests and indictments just based on what happened to here in Oregon and Nevada. But things are getting very interesting. I think I got to believe this trial is probably over.
Yep, I kind of lean that way too. I think they're going to end it. They're just trying to figure out how to do it. And I think people need to be arrested here, and I think this judge is in deep trouble, and hopefully justice will be met for him.
Well, it looks like Judge Navarro has realized that she's been on the wrong side of things. She was visibly upset over finding out about how many lies and hidden things and deceit was being done by the prosecutors.
Well, to be honest with you, I think she was more probably upset of the fact that is being exposed. I'm sure she's aware of that.
That might be.
You know? I believe she's aware of that. That judge is, there's no doubt, the way this judge has been running this whole thing, has been biased from the beginning. And now
he's
trying to appear to be, innocent and all that. Oh, no, really, that's going on? You know, I think this whole thing is a sham.
Well, it was proven.
I think it's going to be shown eventually the truth.
It was proven beyond any doubt. And when it came to releasing more of the defendants, the prosecutors said they wouldn't object. They threw the towel in. They realized they were beat.
Look, she could just be that ignorant. You know, they believe the lies that they're fed, And she probably believed that these were a bunch of redneck patriot terrorist cowboys that didn't want to obey the law. And we're going to get them and show them. You know, they've been fostering this thing against the militias and the patriots for years, and she probably ate that crap up. And when she saw that the FBI and the BLM and all the nasty things they were doing, she realized that she's on the wrong end of things. I mean, look, if people eat this stuff up and they lay themselves down to it because they actually believe it. And like Thornton says, there's nothing so terrible as watching ignorance in action, and that's what she could have been, ignorance in action, you know? But it doesn't excuse her because she's supposed to know. She's in a position right. Where she should know. So she still has something to answer for, but maybe not as much as collusion, as much as just ignorance, you know? I don't know, but I'd give her that benefit anyway.
Well, they were definitely hiding things from her, too. And she found that out.
You know what? That's the way the system operates. They compartmentalize everything. So they don't tell everybody everything anyway. And so maybe she's having an awakening. Hey, maybe she'll turn out to be a good judge when she realizes that everything they told her was a lie. Who knows what can happen, you know?
Well, things are getting exciting anyway. It seems like every day new things are happening.
We'll make her drag her tongue up the main street and up the court steps and all the way up to her bench, and then maybe we'll let her back in after she pays some restitution or something. But hey, she can learn a lesson and be a good judge after that.
Well, just a note on something else too. Just before the call, I was learning that. When Trump entered office, he set up a commission of investigators to investigate all the Obama holdovers and stuff running different agencies, and he had them working with trained spies, and they went in deep cover, and they learned probably yesterday, they talking about maybe it was actually before when they learned about it, but they found that three different departments, Department of Transportation, Department of Agriculture, and I can't remember the other one, but three key departments were being run by Obama deep state agents. And being paid by Obama, and they're members of his new security firm. So, in effect, he was controlling what was happening in government through transportation, agriculture, so controlling the food and transportation and. So that might be interesting to see what happens over that, too.
You know, go ahead, Gerard.
They use a lot of private contractors to do a lot of bad stuff. That's something he has to fix because they use, like, Halliburton and all these different ones to go in and do all their dirty work and then say, well, that we didn't tell them to do that. They did that on their own. They're a corporation, and they just disappear. There's no accounting. So
well, there's a movement to get rid of contractors now too.
Absolutely, it's a big, big problem, and that's how Clinton and Obama make their money because they run those contractors. They're shell corporations inside of other corporations, and you know they hide the money, but basically they're making the money off of it.
That's probably how they control the military-industrial complex. Because
yeah, why wouldn't you want to go to war when you're going to sell all the services to the armed forces, right down to the laundry? I know a guy that was in Mosul in Iraq, and he said we couldn't take our laundry to the local guy, who would only charge us pennies, and we had to take it to the contractor that charged us, I forget what he said, how it was ridiculous, you know, like $12 a load. And if they got caught bringing their laundry to the local people, they'd get court-martialed. That was one of their policies, you know, and that was just feeding Rumsfeld's
you know, contractors.
That's disgusting. All right, Robert, anything else?
No, that's all I got.
Okay, do you know if anyone else has any announcements?
Not that I know of.
Okay. All right, I'm going to pass it over to Gerard. I'll introduce Brent in a minute first.
Gerard, are you ready to take? What do you think? I think Brent is here.
Yeah, I'm going to introduce him.
Oh, okay.
All right,
yeah.
But I just want to turn the panel over to you. I haven't eaten yet, so I'm going to go throw something together real quick and then come back to the computer. But let me go over to Brent. Brent, you here? It looks like you're. Yep, you're here. All right, Brent Winters, the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. And Brent is going to teach us something more about the Constitution or the Declaration, I believe. Brent?
I'm here. Thanks, John. And we've been talking about the Declaration of 76, and we've been going through it blow by blow and clause by clause. I spend about 20 minutes at the allowance of the folks here at National Liberty Alliance. We're in paragraph 15 of our Declaration of 76, and we're right at the end of it, where we left off last time. I'll make one more comment about it. Remember, paragraph 15 says, he, that is King George III, who, always remember, he was king in England, but he was emperor in the Empire of Britain. And so he claimed to be emperor in the American colonies. That means that it was a one-man show. It was the will of one man, and his will was law. That's the way it works, the law of the city, but not in our common law country. And these British subjects here in the colonies took umbrage at that. Of course, they told the people over in India and Pakistan and other places around the world that King George III was emperor, and they didn't bat an eye, because that's what they were used to anyway. So here in the colonies, though, the people said, now, wait a minute, we're British too, and we know the difference, and no, you're not emperor here. Fundamentally, that's one way to put it. That's why we went to war with Britain and separated from them, because they would not acknowledge that the colonists were entitled to the fundamentals of our common law. And the fundamentals of our common law include right to trial by jury. That's not part of the governments around the world. The right to remain silent. The duty, in fact, to remain silent. That's not a part of the governments in other countries in the world. There's only about a handful, about half a dozen countries in the world that have such a standard. And then, of course, the freedom of speech. That's part of our common law tradition. The separation of the powers of government, that's a common law feature. It doesn't exist in the rest of the world. And a whole lot of other things, too numerous to mention. And if you happen to look at the comparative law book, Excellence of the Common Law, somewhere in that book, I don't remember what chapter it is, but I've got cataloged dozens and dozens of the fundamental differences between the law of the land and the law of the city. And it's a matter of some of them overlap, but when you come at it, you just see more and more and more. These are fundamentals of our common law, our law of the land, as our Constitution puts it, that do not exist in the rest of the world. And it is upon these fundamentals that we are able to have the freedoms that we have in a common law country. It is a lot of unwritten standards we take for granted. We assume other people have the same thing. They just flat don't. Well, just talk about this paragraph 15 legislation in our common law sense differs from in the law of the city, the civil law sense. Common law legislation is by indirect consent of the governed through their representatives and by direct consent of the jury. Instance by instance. I'll repeat that. In our common law country, legislation is different than in law of city. Again, every country in the world is under some form of the law of the city, about a half a dozen. Common law legislation is by indirect consent of the governed. We send representatives to a legislative body. Well, that happens sometimes in other countries, but representatives, and by indirect power, we delegate power to them, then they propose legislation. They get together and propose legislation, and then they send that legislation to the chief executive, the president, in a national government anyway, state government, same way. And that legislation is, watch me now, that legislation they send up to the executive is a petition, and it's sent under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, the right to petition. And legislation in our common law country developed that way. When Parliament was first convened, it was convened as a reconstitution of Wittenagemot, the Saxons, the Normans. This used a French word, so they'd been living on the coast of France for about 160 years. Parliament. Men go to parley. When they get together, they get to talk, and they find out, just like on this conference call. People, I know we're all scattered all over the country. We get to talk, and we find out we have things in common. Well, that's what happened with the Parliament for the first time. It's got some of the same problems. They wrote down their problems on a piece of paper, and they all signed it, and they sent it to the king of concerned about, we want you to do something about it. Well, it got so, after a century or so, that the king, the custom developed, he will sign their petitions, their grievances, say, I agree with you. Well, when he signed them and said he agreed, they took that to be law. The court started taking that to be law. Said, well, here's what Parliament and the king have agreed on, so we're going to enforce it. And that's how we developed certain times, although it in an oral tradition for that, but in times, that's how the right of petition arose indirectly to the elders. The elders, the landholders in England, especially, where they had upper house, also landholders too, they were commoners, and that means they held small pieces of land in common with others. All of these things have a reason, but legislation is the right to petition, and we also have the right to petition when we file papers in court. We do that under the protection of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. Right to petition government. Address them. So that's what a court is. Well, all of these things are fundamentally simple if they're put in the right context and take the right rules. Well, that's the way it is in a common law country. In a law of the country, legislation is the command of the state, period. Legislation is enforced command the state. Doesn't make any difference whether it's expression of one man or a combination of men. That ends it, and in those countries, the courts, they're not really courts, they're just tribunals, they exist for one reason, and that is to vindicate legislation, vindicate the will of the state, to vindicate the command of the state. And judges are not lawyers. They're trained special for the job. They're civil service positions. They're beholden. In France and Germany, South America and Sweden, they're beholden to whoever put them to that position for their pay and their job. And if they don't rule right, if they don't support the powers that be, they're going to get fired. It's that simple. That's why we have in our common law country, and we enshrine it in our Constitution, the common law standard that once it's appointed, you can't fire him. Why? Well, if you could fire the judge, you can control it. You get one in that does what you want. If you're a powerful person, like a president, for example. But that would be contrary, you see, to our separation of powers. For the branches of government has a duty at common law to exercise independent judgment and do what it thinks is right, regardless. People say, oh, Congress or the courts have a duty to uphold Congress's legislation. No, they don't. If they think it's constitutional, if they think it's lawful, if they think it's consistent with our common law, well, yes, they have a duty to uphold it. But if it isn't, they have a duty to say that they don't support it. And really, that's all a court can do is say we don't support it, but that has a lot of influence. Well, our common law demands that legislation be constitutional. That is, within common law principles. And that bars powerful men's legislative decree through a president and his administrative tribunal or his administrative bureaucracy, through admiralty law bureaucrats, acts I'm quoting the Declaration of 76, acts of pretended legislation. Now we get to this interesting one. This is the 16th paragraph of our Declaration of 76. Let me read it. It says this, and it says that they were upset. This is the Declaration of 76 is a petition, of course, and of sorts. It says that for court, here's why we're separate from Britain, because Britain, the king, Emperor George III, quartered large bodies of armed troops among us. And people say, well, we don't have a problem with that. They're not quartering large bodies of armed troops among us. You don't think they are? Listen, back then, those large bodies of armed troops were British regulars, those red coats. They called them lobster backs in Boston. And they were everywhere. Stayed in people's houses. They were obliged, the government said, to feed them. Why? Why did they do that? Well, they did it back then for the same reason. They put government employees, federal employees, in every little village and hamlet in America, called post offices. There's a politically correct control reason for that. Post offices were put in little places in America in order to control Americans, in order that the federal government would know who's communicating with who and why. And if the word went out, they'd tell the postmaster, well, keep an eye out, and keep a list of the letters this fellow gets and who he writes. And postmasters have been doing that since the days of the war between the northern and the southern tiers of states. And that's when the post offices became prevalent, and they became, by monopoly, government control. Before that, they were contracted privately. And there are a lot of private contractors that carried letters back then until the federal government said, we know we want a monopoly on letter carrying. Why? So we can keep track of who's talking to who. Why? Well, it says here, quartering bodies of troops among us. You see, the application of these first principles of common law government, that we should allow the government to quarter large troops among us, where the evil empire has more than one way to skin that cat. If they don't troops, they'll put a lot of federal employees back in the 1930s. The Roosevelt administration, he, of course, was a socialist of sorts. He was interested in powerful government from the top down, and so he established a welfare system that had not been known in our country before. And in establishing that welfare system, what he did was, and he wanted to control the whole country from Washington, D.C., so he put in every county in the United States, and yet today there's one of these offices in every county, a federal office called the ASCS office. ASCS. Now, if you grew up in a place like I did where there weren't many government installations and we lived in a small rural county, you'd find out or you'd have known that there's an ASC office in every county. I knew that from the time I was a little boy. Now, why did I know that? Because there weren't any government buildings around. They had one of the nicer buildings in a little town close by called the ASCS office. And through the ASCS office, and by the way, that's the United States Department of Agriculture, that's what those offices were, and through those offices was administered the food stamp program under Roosevelt. And when I was growing up, the food stamp program was administered through there. I even, in this little town near where I grew up, was a small printer who eventually got the contract to print, for crying out loud, the food stamps for the federal government. They also had a contract to print the little tubes that they used to use out in Las Vegas to roll up coins. Banks would roll up, put pennies in and stuff. They had a machine that did that. He developed himself to kind of a bit of Americana there, I suppose. But he also had that lucrative business. Of course, stamps are not used anymore. Now they have electronic cards instead of the physical stamps. But the ASCS office was another attempt beyond the post offices to put a federal presence in every county, over 3,000 counties in the United States, instead of having state control, federal control. I want to mention something I just noticed, and I don't know why people didn't make more of this recently. Of course, since 2015, there was a girl walking down on the Embarcadero And I'm familiar with the Embarcadero because I used to live there. I used to be on a ship tied up at the Embarcadero in San Francisco, down on the pier. Well, this gal was walking along the Embarcadero with her father, and an illegal alien that had been deported about five times shot her with a pistol. Well, he claimed he found the pistol. He was acquitted recently, as you know, maybe. He claimed he found the pistol under a bench, a park kind of a bench, wrapped in a cloth, and he picked it up and claimed that it went off. Well, the jury said that it ricocheted off the ground, and the slug flew 78 feet, hit this girl, and killed her. And so they concluded it was an accident. He no way could have tried to kill her, but there is such a thing as being indiscriminate with firearms, and the negligence would amount to murder or manslaughter at the least. But he was acquitted. But nobody said where this pistol came from, and they discovered that this pistol was stolen out of an auto, belonged to a BLM agent, a Bureau of Land Management agent that had parked his car, and somebody got in his car. He must have left it unlocked or something, but he didn't have his gun on him, and they stole the gun. And there again, the left wing is screaming and hollering about guns being available to people. They can steal them out of people's houses. We got to get rid of people's guns. Well, the truth of the matter is that the BLM agents get their guns available to illegal aliens. But that's a side note I wanted to throw in because we've been talking about the Bureau of Land Management so much. But quartering large troops is a federal presence, government presence. With England, it was the presence of the government, the eyes and of every soldier are the eyes and the ears of the government. Consider this. If you're quartering troops in your home, just like the postman that comes by your house, he's a federal employee. He knows everything about you. He knows what cars are in the driveway, and sometimes those fellows are given, of course, the papers to carry and given assignments, what to watch, fugitives, all those kind of things. The postman knows it all. And that's the way it is also, and that's the way it was, of course, when they had troops everywhere. They were the eyes and ears of the government. And it's not true, by the way, about postmen, because I've had the experience of knowing that they do watch people, and we've caught them doing it. I've caught them doing it with my own clients. They've been given orders from above. And they have a monopoly on letter carrying, which is unconstitutional. The Constitution doesn't grant the federal government a letter carrying that the Congress has given them. It's wrong. It's lost. And it comes down, though, to control. Well, if you have large bodies of troops in your home, shall have the eyes and ears of the government in your home. The things like the Fourth Amendment. Sure way to use the law of the city to dominate a people, to quarter soldiers in family homes. Why do I say that? Because when a soldier enters your home, what does he bring with him besides a gun? He brings with him the martial law. The martial law. The military law that governs him, brings with him. And if he is in your home living, then that law dominates that household, not to mention his eyes and ears for the government. Insert British soldiers in the homes. The King of England and his co-conspirators brought home and family, the building blocks of colonial strength of that day, brought it under martial law, direct surveillance and control. Within the walls of your house lies the family, or some part of a family, even if broken, nonetheless, the family. Family is property, self-government. It's the true authority for self-government. God made it that way. I can't change it. And if there is no self-government, God's government, in the family or whatever's left of it, there is no government at all. Not in a church, not in a state capital. And you say, well, wow, look around me. There is lawlessness. And what is lawlessness? It's lack of good government. And why is it? Because health, education, and welfare institution land is disintegrating. And so there is no government. What is that institution? With the family. And without privacy in the home, government control of people is total. Let me repeat. Without privacy in the home, government's control of the people is total. That's what we mean when we say totalitarianism. That's why our common law, for instance, has the old, what they call the ancient castle. Every man's home is his castle. Boy, do the left-wing whackouts hate that. I've heard about it. They want DCFS in every house. They want to break down the authority of the man of the home and of the mother. They want to destroy it. And they're doing a very effective job. Amazing. The Americans let them get away with it. It's madness that they're doing it. Always stop. And we will not have good government unless there is privacy in the home. You say, well, there are abuses in the home. Yes, there are. But the government's the one that will make the worst abuses. It's bad enough that we have that we are who we are and we have the problems we have just as private individuals. But you bring government into it, and what you do is bring private individuals, and you get power, and then it exacerbates their evil. As Acton said, powerful men are all bad men. Is that true? Well, in my experience, it's been that way. Very dangerous to give a man power over what God didn't give power, have authority to have power over. And once you do that, you're just asking to be abused. I know some people like to be abused. I've noticed that. It's odd. That's the deplorable condition of mankind, but it's true. They like it. They like to be taken care of. They like to be irresponsible. They have no gumption breath left in their bodies. They want somebody else to tell them what to do and protect them. Well, wherever soldiers occupy, martial law governs. And that's why they were upset that they were quartering soldiers in the homes. But the federal government has inserted its employees everywhere. And just because they don't call them soldiers doesn't mean the principle must still apply. A grievance of this paragraph 16 is akin to that grievance of paragraph 13. Only words. And the reason behind are Amendment 3 of our Constitution, which forbids, I'll quote it, it forbids that any soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner. You see how our Constitution, I just read the Constitution, how it acts with the Declaration of Fundamental Principle. The Declaration of 76 complains of quartering large bodies of armed troops among us. The Constitution of the United States says it forbids that soldiers shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without consent of the owner. Then, paragraph 7, that the colonies are breaking away from Britain because the British government, king, protects these soldiers by mock trial, I'm reading, from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of these states. Soldiers were murdering colonists. Trials were held. They were mock trials. Soldiers, as I said a while ago, are rightly under law. And freedom demands, however, that their murdering of non-military men and women subject them to common law courts with the jury. Otherwise, if they aren't subjected to our common law courts for the crimes they commit, government will use its soldiers to eliminate opposition without fear of punishment. But the king and parliament of that day ordered that any British officer or soldier accused of violence be sent to another colony or England to get a sweetheart trial. Acquitted. I'm going to quit there, but just to make a point, I don't know what the military is like, but I remember taking men, military men, to court in a non-military court in the town where they had gotten in trouble. And the courts of those towns demanded that these military men be brought to them to stand trial for wrongs committed in that community. That's the way it ought to be. And if it hurt them and their military record, they have to be gone to be tried for a crime, put in jail, so be it. And that's the way our military used to operate. They did not have sovereign immunity as military men, amazingly. And I don't know if they do now or not. Now, it is true that if the military unit they were attached to took jurisdiction first, might be able to save them from a trial off the path. But because of good relationships, it wasn't always done. If the folk out in town wanted to have a shot of a soldier or sailor, they were allowed the opportunity to do that by trial by jury. Well, John, I've been talking about enough. Thanks again for letting me say a few words. Mad at the end, my points of view may or may not agree with those of National Liberty Alliance. They're my points of view. I stand on my feet, and they stand on theirs, although I'm sure, and I experienced, I agree at many points. Back to what John isn't there, is he? Back to you, Gerard, right?
Okay. Thank you, Brent. Appreciate it. Very good. Yeah. Let me see here. Let me go to, I think it's Eric. Yes, Eric, you've been unmuted. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I have a question for you, Brent and John. John was talking about how, people will yield to him and he'll yield to others. And the traffic videos that you have, and they're good videos. But he was saying that certain people are like, oh, you can't not allow the cops to write people tickets and stuff. Well, anyway, in a few of the blogs, I've only written a handful, but they're up at NLA. I think I'm the only blogger at this point. But I started a series called Myth of the Thin Blue Line. And I write about this, about cops and the idea that they're the thin blue line between chaos and civility. My argument was not only do they not promote civility, they actually promote chaos because people forget that they, and it's just like John was saying, people forget they have a duty, they have a responsibility, and this is why liberty does scare people. But when the cops are around, people are like, oh, I don't have to do anything because that's what the cops are there for. And so not only do cops not promote civility, is my argument, they promote chaos because people begin to degenerate. So I just want to make that point. And then so a few weeks ago I had said that this is leading to my question, that based upon the study and I've done, Washington could have crushed the Redcoats several times, but Congress was too afraid to give him a standing army. And, a lot of those people had studied history, and so they had a good reason for not giving him a standing army, because a standing army is a frightening thing. And so since then, I've noticed a few things that have come up, and to tie in the private military contractors, there's a lot been talked about this Eric Prince fella, this guy who started Blackwater. Well, I understand that he's promoted the idea that mercenaries were a part of American history. I wanted to ask you, John, and Brent, I can't find any place, and it seems incredibly un-American and anti-Christian, the mercenaries. I know we fought mercenaries. We fought the Hessians when the Redcoats employed them, when King George employed them, and they were mercenaries. And I guess you could call certain of the Indians that were against us, they too were mercenaries. But, John or Brent talks about how, some of our men had to go and reclaim land back, land such as the Ohio Valley or Ohio, and then what would be Ohio and Michigan. But I'm pretty sure that was probably just militiamen. I guess it could have been the Army. And then further, I saw another story from that fellow that we discuss in here sometimes, but we discuss him for other things, and that's the health ranger, Mike Adams. But he had a video about this, and he said that some of his friends in the private military, the contractor world, they were saying they've been told, this is very recently, to be on guard or to be on alert because they might get called into service, and they were saying it might be domestic. And the idea he was promoting was that even if these men were employed by the military, they had were in service a year ago, as long as they were no longer in service now, they could become a part of the posse comitatus. And that to me seems inappropriate, and I don't think our founding fathers would allow for that kind of a thing. That they could actually they could be part of the militia. And so that's my question, is that do we have mercenaries in our history? I don't think we do. And also, is it possible for men who serve in the military, I mean, I guess, you know, if you get cut from, say, you got cut from the Revolutionary War and you went home and ended, I guess you could go ahead and assume your position back in the militia, but this seems kind of like a loophole to allow these contractors to come into our territory and perhaps establish martial law. Anyway, that's my question, if you can see what I'm getting at.
Oh, I see what you're getting at, and I was chafing at the bit to say something because this is important. I'll start by saying when I exited military service, I was offered $1,400 a month to go to Africa and do what I had learned how to do. And $1,400 a month back then, over 40 years ago, was a lot of money. And when you're a young fella, I'm telling this story to say that I understand the temptation of such things, because you've been a fellow that trained to do certain things, and you think you're good at it, and that's what military life does. It pumps you up to think you're good and you're indestructible. So otherwise, people couldn't fight battles in those days. I didn't do that, but I have done a lot of looking into this, and I want to start reading. This is a subject near and dear to my heart. I want to start by reading the testimony of from the only memoir of a young revolutionary soldier from the Continental Army, J.P. Martin, 16, and he got out at age 23 when the war was over. He was in Yorktown. He saw a lot of skirmishes, a lot of battles, a lot of hard scrapes. But listen to what he wrote. After a battle, he went back. He went back through with his comrades, he says, battlefield that had occurred there, and he remembers the fight and described what happened at that fight in gruesome detail with the British. And I'm going to read his draft from his memoirs. He said this: "I, with some of my comrades who were in the Battle of the White Plains in the year of 76, one day took a ramble on the ground where we were then engaged with the British." Excuse me. I'll continue reading from what he wrote. "We saw a number of the graves of those who had fell in that battle. Some of the bodies had so slightly buried that the dogs or the hogs or both had dug them out of the ground. Their skulls and other bones and hair were scattered about the place. Here were Hessians, holes as thick as a bombshell. Poor fellows! They were left unburied in a foreign land. They had, perhaps, as near and dear friends to lament their sad destiny as the Americans who lay buried near them. But they should have kept at home. We should then never have gone after them to kill them in their own country. But the reader will say, they were forced to come and be killed here, forced by their rulers who have absolute power of life and death over their subjects." And then he ends this way. This is the stabbing point. He says, "Well, then, reader, bless a kind providence that has made such a distinction between your condition and theirs. And be careful, too, that you do not allow yourself to be brought up to such an abject and servile condition." What he's saying is the abject and servile condition of which J.P. Martin here speaks is that of those subject to rulers who conscript and sell their subjects' lives and military services to a foreign power under officers, as we now do in our own country, under foreign officers of the United Nations of some other country, doing the bidding of evil perverts on the other side of the world. That's what's happening to our military now, as we speak. And the Hessians, fighting Americans in that day, were enslaved, watch this, enslaved to King George III, because King George III was a German prince, but also King of England. He had power over there, he had power here. And he took those men, those mercenary men, and he rented them to himself as King of England to send to America. Here he was, he rented them to himself. In other words, he took British money and paid himself to send those men. That's what we call corporate shams. That's what the IRS accuses people of today, that the government of America does all day long. He was a German prince doing that. The lives of Hessians, which were feared for all by their ruthless prowess in battle, and they were ruthless. They had become, the young men and the Hessians, like the Prussians, identified themselves as warriors. They wanted to go fight. Their respect as men demanded it, that they be mercenaries. That's perversion to do that. The same thing happened in Switzerland. And during the days of the Reformation in Switzerland, the leader of the Reformation was a man by the name of Ulrich Zwingli. He was a German-speaking Swiss man. And he said, how can I get people woke up? Because in that day, the only money in Switzerland was money that came from Rome, that the Pope paid young Swiss men to come and serve in his mercenary army. And they fought all over Europe and killed people and were killed. And he finally got to the Swiss people with the message and said, now, wait a minute. And of course, they became the rage. That's what all the young men wanted to do. That was the only way to get money in those days. Well, they wanted to go down there and risk their lives. And of course, they'd come back without arms and legs or crazier lunatics, having fought in battles that for a foreign dictator called the Pope of Rome. And he said, this has got to stop. The flower of youth is being destroyed in devotion to this priest down in Rome, an Italian. We don't even know the man. Well, he finally got their attention, and the Reformation did occur in Switzerland. But that is tyranny and mercenary life. And this prince, somebody said he was an ex-UDT man in the Navy or something. That's hogwash. He either doesn't know or he's lying. It's not true. Mercenaryism is contrary to our common law, and it's contrary to freedom. And to be caught up in it, to be the brunt of it, the victim of it, or to be caught up in doing it, is evil. God doesn't brook it anywhere in his law written in the Bible, and there's a lot written about mercenaries in the Bible. It's not something that's ever given leave to do. Well, one more comment, maybe we'll mention this later, as a German prince, King George III, demanded a large lease payment from the Hessians. A large lease payment. And as King of Britain, he borrowed that payment from England's central bank and laid the interest payments on the backs of the British people. He received that lease payment for his Hessian soldiers and invested it in Germany's central bank, which owned England's central bank. Thus, using enslaved Hessians, he enslaved the British to the bankers through debt and then tried to use the Hessians to enslave the colonists to the same cabal of theft using raw force. That's called a shenanigan. That's what the Irish would call it. Shenanigan. My mother called it. And our common law abhors all such shenanigans. Well, this is self-dealing is what we call it today. But no, mercenaryism is not part of it's not part of Christianity, therefore it's not part of our common law, it's not part of our American culture. And when we went to Europe in World War I, we probably shouldn't have gone, but we did go. And when we got there, Black Jack Pershing, was commander-in-chief of the troops there at the time, and when he got there, the French said, here's what we're going to do, and we're going to take your men, we're going to do this, that. And he said, whoa, wait a minute. No, you're not going to take my men and do anything. You bozos have been over here for 4 years at a stalemate, killing each other, pants on either side. Doing 4 years and haven't done. And he said, my boys are not going to be under anybody's command but mine, American officers. And never in the history of our country has mass allowed boys to be under anybody but American officers. Oh, yeah, there have been other officers that have been under American officers. But never have our boys been under command of a foreign sovereign like we see today. And if it doesn't stop, we're going to destroy our country. For what it's worth, my comments on mercenaryism.
Yeah, love it. Love it. That's what I figured. And yeah, that's brilliant. Okay. Well, I guess that'll do it for me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you calling, Eric. I always like to hear from you. And by the way, I have a section on mercenaryism in the book called Our Constitution and Declaration of 76. And there's a section in there on what mercenary is, how that figures into our Constitution and our Declaration of 76, and why it's an important subject, and why those who have gone before us have guarded against it, and we're not guarding against it. But you can find that, I think, at Amazon.com. If you don't find it there, you can find it at commonlawyer.com. It's called A Common Lawyer Comments, Our Constitution and Declaration of 76.
Excellent. I have a copy, and I'll just go consult my copy. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Rick.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for that, guys. That was good. Okay, next. Looks like Connecticut. Eric, go ahead. You've been unmuted. Actually, it says you're muted, though. Hang on. Go ahead, Eric. You're unmuted now.
No, that's me again, brother.
Oh, you were still in the queue. I don't know why.
Yeah, I don't know why either.
You didn't get back in. You didn't get back in?
No, not that I know of.
All right, I'll go to the next guy. I don't know. It's a 914 number. I have no idea who it is. So just give us your name and your state. And go ahead. You're unmuted.
Hello, good evening. This is Professor Solange Martinez. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. I have a question regarding an illegal eviction. I received an eviction from my mother's landlord, even though I didn't rent an apartment because I don't have any income and I don't work since 2011. The illegal eviction doesn't have a docket number. It tells me that I have to answer within 3 days before the court date. And as I understand it, if you are served in person, you have 30 days to answer an eviction. If you are served not in person by papers, then you have 60 days to answer the eviction. The eviction has a serving papers that lists me as the plaintiff, lists my mother and myself as the plaintiff on the proof of service. It also tells me that they are going to go ahead with the eviction, even though my mother and I have declared bankruptcy. And according to the federal law, bankruptcy law, if you file for bankruptcy, that stops the eviction. So they're disrespecting the judge who is handling the bankruptcy, and they're also filing a lawsuit, an eviction against the wrong person. The time of the court for the eviction is at 4 o'clock. They close at 3 o'clock. So my mother and I think that they have an illegal eviction. They don't want anybody to be around, and they probably plan a false arrest or something like that because the people who are involved in this are involved in racketeering and are very, very dangerous people that we have to report because they have been deferring the United States federal government, the United States government Federal Reserve account with my mother's identity in mind by enrolling us in dozens of government agencies and getting a Section 8, 10 of Monica in cash, food stamps, money for furniture and money for clothing, Medicaid and other things from the government, and we never authorized that. We never saw a penny of that. So what they do is they enroll you if you qualify, and they sell the benefits to illegal aliens in the country. And the taxpayers and the government end up paying for free care for illegal aliens and also free housing, electricity assistance, and everything else. So my mother and I were forced to report these people. And after I reported these people, then they started to harass us and contacting all our landlords and telling them to illegally evict us. And since they have the connections with the local courts, they do that. My mother and I have moved 6 times in 1 year, and we haven't even unpacked from the last move, and they are evicting us with the aforementioned papers.
So what's your question? I mean, look.
My question is there something that can be done for this false eviction? Because obviously it doesn't have a docket number. The eviction lists me as and my mother as the plaintiff in the serving papers, and on the eviction, the wife, there are 2 landlords, the wife and the husband. The eviction lawsuit lists me as the defendant, and the wife is filing the eviction petition against me. But they don't have any evidence that I rented the apartment because I don't have an income. So it is ridiculous for somebody to think that they're going to rent an apartment to somebody who doesn't have an income.
Look, if you're living there, it doesn't matter. They can evict you. Whether you're paying or you're not paying, there's an eviction that happens if they want you out. Now, they have to give 30 days. The 4-day is after the 30 days is up. Then they give a 4-day warning. Then they go to the sheriff. You're in New York City? Is that where you're at?
No, I'm in upstate New York. But I filed for bankruptcy, and that stopped the eviction.
Well, it should. But you see, the trouble is the guys that are racketeering in the courts, they have everybody under their tutelage, so to speak. You know, they got the judges, they got everything. So what are you going to do? You're going to appeal to that court? They're not going to give you any kind of, remedy because they're doing it illegal. Now, you say you never got a notice from them for the 30 days?
No, I never got it. They sent me a lawsuit saying that they were evicting me, but they don't have any evidence that they rented me the apartment.
That doesn't matter. If you're in there, they can evict you, and you don't have to rent the apartment. The fact is you're there. I mean, look, if I let you in my house, and I let you sleep there, and you stay there for any numbers of days, and I don't know what the law is, don't quote me because I'm not a lawyer, but I know that once you establish your residency there, if I want you out, I have to go through a 30-day eviction proceeding. And whether you paid rent or you didn't pay rent, it makes no difference. So The law says I got to give you 30 days, and then there's a couple more procedure, a 4-day, and then a 3-day, and the sheriff comes in and kicks you out. I don't know what they're playing with you on your case. If you're in bankruptcy, technically that should stop it. I mean, that's if they're doing an eviction due to non-payment. But if you don't have a lease, they can evict you for any reason. But if they're saying for non-payment, usually you have the judges are pretty lenient with tenants. As long as somebody comes up with some money, they'll extend it. It can take a long, long time to evict somebody, especially this time of year. I don't know what they're playing down there, and
I used to see it that way, Gerard, because years ago it was very difficult to get someone out. The judges, gave more time and so on. Mm-hmm. But these last, I don't know, I've seen a few evictions over the past years, and they're ruthless, and they don't seem to be like that anymore. And I do know that someone I know that got evicted, I mean, once they served the papers to the court, they required them to come in. I think it was in 7 days that they had to come into the court, They don't follow any real rule of law.
They're probably doing that in rem, John. They probably changed everything to the in rem thing now, so all that other stuff isn't standing anymore.
Yeah, they don't follow any rule of law anymore. And, I don't know if they ever did in this anyway with the eviction stuff and so on, but I don't know enough about that, but... But, you know, if rights are being violated, you can move it into federal court, but you have to really have a cause to do that. And the cause could be, you know, the right of due process. If it's not a court of law, you know, that's they really evict you? I don't know. But it is interesting, you know, to look into the, if you're filing for bankruptcy, look into the bankruptcy law, because I do know that once you put something up and you file bankruptcy and a person's name is on that, if you got the landlord's name on that, I don't know how any way that they can pursue that at that point. It's their court.
Exactly.
That's what they told me in federal court. They said,
did you talk to the federal court?
Accept it.
You went and talked to the judge at the bankruptcy court?
Yes, and the bankruptcy court. They told me, you give this to the landlord, and that stops the eviction.
Okay, all right. And they're still going forward anyway?
Exactly.
And did you give a copy to the judge? Hold on. Did you give a copy to the judge?
Of the eviction, yes.
No. What the bankruptcy court gave you to give to the landlord, did you give a copy of that to the judge?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And he's still for going forward with the eviction hearing?
The landlord, yes.
No. The judge is allowing, given a date to continue?
No, the judge is calling the landlords to be before him so they can explain why they are disregarding the bankruptcy laws and his order.
I'm sorry, who's going?
He said the judge called the landlord in to question him why he's not obeying the bankruptcy.
Oh, well, then you're pretty safe, it sounds.
Yeah, he shouldn't be able to do it.
Yes, and the next question is, if the landlord was shown evidence that my mother's Social Security Disability Award, court-ordered award, was stolen, he is showing malicious persecution, because he knows that his money is going to be paid to him as soon as my mother gets her Social Security disability check, which was stolen, and she already commenced a lawsuit to get the money back. So it's not like my mother is saying she's not going to pay him.
Who's the lease, or who's the agreement on who's renting?
Well, my mother is renting, and I am an ocular witness that witnessed the landlord saying that they agreed to get paid their rent money from my mother's Social Security disability check, which was stolen by government.
Let me understand this a little better here. So your mother is the renter, and you're living with her, so you're not really on the lease or anything of that nature, right?
No, and there is no lease, because it was verbal agreement.
But nevertheless, the agreement, whether it's verbal or written, is with your mother and not with you, right?
Exactly.
Okay, and the bankruptcy judge is aware of this?
Exactly.
Okay, and the judge in the court that you're going to, I presume, is a town court, he's aware of it?
No, I wrote him a letter because they are... telling us to go to court after the court is closed, and it closes at 3:00. They're telling us to go to court at 4:00 when there is nobody there, and my mother is disabled. So I wrote him a letter saying to please in regards to the American Disability Act of 1990, to accommodate her and give her a better time from, say, 9 a.m. until 2 o'clock, because at 4 o'clock in the countryside, it's almost dark, and my mother can trip and fall. You know, all kinds of things can happen. So she didn't answer. He hasn't answered my letter, but it is the day after tomorrow, December 6th, and... I wonder if he's going to go forward with the eviction after a federal judge already gave me the papers, and I gave them the papers. So his lawyer,
right,
won't go forward.
But I'm wondering how to interpret this problem. If you filed the bankruptcy and you're living in the house with your mother, and your mother has the agreement with the landlord, you know, there's a little bit of a problem there in trying to figure out how the law would go on this. Brent, you got any ideas on this?
I'll tell you what, if she's living there, they have to evict her also.
Yes, well, my mother already filed for bankruptcy, too, so we both filed for bankruptcy.
Oh, so you're both in the thing. Oh, okay.
They should have put the papers in their bulk. Now, I would just go in with that paper from the federal judge and say, Your Honor, these hearings are illegal. The judge has already ordered them to stop. We don't know what you're doing here, but you have no authority to do
that. Let me tell you what you do. You go into court. If you find out that they really kind of kangaroo-courted you and you, all of a sudden you find yourself getting evicted, you need to object to the process immediately. You need to inform the judge, I'm putting you on notice now that I'm moving this into federal court for cause. You need to then get, there's got to be some identification to that case. There's something there other than a name. There's a number somewhere. Go down to the clerk, get a number. You move it into federal court for cause. And the cause you're moving it in for, I'm sure you could find what you found concerning, first of all, what you found concerning the bankruptcy laws. You could bring that in there. You can also use your letter for that. And you could talk to, you know, bring in the fact that you're not getting due process, that, you know, this judge is really just ignoring the law and you're not having your right of due process take place. And that's your cause of action, is due process. there is a problem going into federal court. I know I just recently filed something in federal court, and they never really hit me for this before, but they wanted to have a code for the cause. And actually I was surprised because the clerk kind of helped me. I said, yeah, I already got that in there. He suggested putting in 42, USC 42, was it 1982 or 83 or something. And I told them, well, I've already got that quoted in the case. And he said, well, that works out good. Put that statute there. Because they didn't want to see what constitutional rights, or shall I say unalienable rights, protected by the Constitution, what part of the Bill of Rights I was coming in on. They wanted to see a statute. So you're going to want to find a statute that works for you. You can go for the judge and look at it. If it's clear to you and you're absolutely sure that this whole thing is a fraud by the judge, because that's what he may be doing, then you take him into the federal court also for fraud on the court.
Okay.
Any officer who commits fraud on a court, you know, that's what it's called, fraud on a court.
Oh,
why is he having a special hearing at 4 o'clock, an hour after the court closed? That's not good.
Yeah, that's another concern that you might want to raise. But again, you're going to have to act very, very quickly. I would be preparing my paperwork right now. I would have in my back pocket a notice of being moved to federal court. And I would have all my papers written up and ready to rock and roll. And the following morning, I'd be at the federal court filing, moving that case over.
How did she get a federal judge to order the judge to stop the eviction?
Well, look, at the moment she files, she can file it as an emergency, but the moment she files into federal court and the moment she serves onto that judge that she's moving it into court for cause, you know, look, at that in itself should stop them.
But
if he's not being stopped by the federal judge in the bankruptcy court, then he may not feel so compromised, you know, so concerned about, you know, stopping on the other end. So, you know, you're going to want to maybe even, you know, they give you a judge right away. You know, they give you the name of a judge. You can then try to get an appointment with the judge to ask the judge for some protection.
Yes, a motion is being filed with the federal bankruptcy judge, asking him to ask the landlord to go to federal court and explain why they are disrespecting his doing in the federal bankruptcy laws.
Well, that's interesting, because maybe you can work this all out through that judge in the bankruptcy court, because, look, at the bankruptcy court is a court acknowledged in the Constitution. That judge, you might be able to work something out with him to stop the other judge. And again, you know, I don't know if Brent is still here. He would probably have more experience in this than I would. That's sort of what I would be doing. I'd go talk to that judge, too.
I agree, yes. And the other question is that everything that caused this was the stealing of my mother's Social Security court-ordered disability award by the Department of Social Services Commissioner and the Social Security Administration Commissioner. because they are involved in racketeering. Now they are coming to our home to harass my mother almost every day or so, and they are saying that if we don't do whatever they tell us to do, they're going to continue to steal her Social Security disability check, and this is the fourth month that they steal the check. So they come here with the police. They harass us. My mother filed a federal lawsuit against the police officers who come here to harass her, and they are tampering with the witness of a federal lawsuit and the plaintiff. And we called the marshal. Nothing is done. We called the FBI. Nothing is done. We called the Secret Service.
All this that you're telling us, did you write this up in an affidavit yet?
Yes.
Okay, and you gave it to the federal judge in the bankruptcy court?
No, I'm giving it to the federal judge because my
yes,
mother...
Yes, where you want to go. You want to get this affidavit to the federal judge in the bankruptcy court and see where he thinks you should go. I mean, maybe, you know, and it sounds like he may have some power and authority to deal with this because the case is under his umbrella, so to speak. So.
Okay, perfect. And the problem with the Social Security check, they still refuse.
Who's stealing the Social Security check? Who's taking the money?
Nancy Berryhill, she's the Social Security Administration Office acting commissioner, the new commissioner, and she has two state commissioners, Beatrice Disman and Frederick Maureen, and the Livingston County, the local social services commissioner, who are involved in the selling of American citizens' identities and government benefits to illegals, and that way defraud the United States government Federal Reserve account by trafficking with these benefits. But what I want to know is there something that I can do to stop these criminals from coming to harass my mother almost every day?
Well, what county are you in?
In Mount Morris, New York, and
yeah.
That's about 45 minutes away from Canada.
Well, what do you know? What county? Is it Morris County?
Livingston County.
There is a Morris County. I think there is, isn't there?
What county?
Livingston County is the county.
What is it?
Livingston County.
Livingston. Okay. Have you called the sheriff?
Yes, the sheriff is involved in the racketeering, and he sent police officers to try to provoke a heart attack on my mother or an epileptic seizure. And he also sent police officers to say that they thought that I had a gun in my hand, and that's why they grabbed their guns and were going to basically shoot me. But I had a phone. I called 911 because I knew that they were up to no good.
All right, well, look, it sounds like your first order of business is to get that affidavit into the hands of the judge over there at the bankruptcy court and see if you could move it there for cause or do you have to or what he can do. And see where you go from there.
Good, I agree. And my last question is I have a case because I had a news channel. And I reported racketeering by government employees. And the next thing I knew was a government employee had a police informant who is a drug dealer and a women abuser and a child abuser and an elderly abuser accused me of defaming him. So the police did false police reports. And after I called the police for about 24 or 23 times, asking the police to help me because this man wanted to kill me and my mother, then the police turned around and said that what I said never happened, that they went into the house and the rifle that they confiscated for this multiple felon who has been in and out of jail since the age of 12 is untrue. Everything that happened is untrue. And they had him posed as my husband, my boyfriend, or my significant other at the time that they issued an order of protection against me because I posted the police reports on my news channels and on my media accounts. And they said that I was defaming him because he had no criminal record. So I contacted the federal government, and I got his criminal record. They are about 7 inch long, and they have a lot of felonies, which the district attorney, the local district attorney, knocked down and put them as a misdemeanor, as misdemeanors, in order for him to be released on the street so he can continue to work with the racketeering involved people that I have reported in my news channel. Now that they have been reported by me some more, they gave the case from one judge to another judge, but the other judge is a new judge. Since I went to get the six different docket numbers history that I have with my name in that court, and I couldn't find any history or any of those docket numbers in the court computer, so I went to the clerk, and they told me that the docket numbers there are not found, that I'm not found in any of the computers.
Are you in the county court or the town court or the state court?
County court.
A county court, okay. Because the county court is a court of record in New York State. All right. And so now what's your question here?
My question is, the previous judge wanted me to supposedly take a psychiatric examination because he wants to know if I am able to defend myself because he's...
Yeah, that's a game they play. You want to do everything you can to resist that. It's dangerous to do that down in New York City, we found out. But up here, you might have a better chance of dealing with it. Gerard, what do you think? Because we saw what happened down in New York with a couple of people on that. Well... Either Gerard is away or he is muted.
What they wanted to do, get a mental evaluation?
Yeah, they tried to do that with a lot of people we know, haven't they?
I wouldn't go at all. They can't make you do it. They can't enforce that.
Yeah, but I mean, upstate New York, I don't think she'd have a problem. Down in the city, you know, we know what they do down there. It's a whole different world.
She's dealing
what
with
happened
criminals.
Is that she wants
they
me
probably
to...
have the doctor in their pocket. I wouldn't let them do anything. They cannot.
Yeah, what happened is that he wants me to be removed from my mother's side, because since my mother is disabled, what they do is they order you for a psychiatric evaluation.
Right, so then they'll appoint her somebody to take control over her estate and
come and take
get
her away.
The fiduciary authority by the judge ordering the some lawyer. Yeah, I'm aware.
They're probably tied up with the eviction people, so they get her out of there. They get the mother in social services. The house is empty, and they come in and take it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Well, look at it. It sounds like really you're not going to know what to do until what step to take after until you talk with the bankruptcy judge.
Yes,
bring
I'm
your
going
affidavit
to go back
with you. Complete affidavit of what you told us. Bring that story with you.
Yes, I will. So this is what I'm going to do. Thank you so much.
All right.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to the next one. That was kind of long there. We've got California Fred. You're unmuted. Are you there?
And star 6 if anybody wants to get into the queue.
Yes,
did we put you to sleep, Fred?
No. I've got a little process. Give me a second.
All right, I'm having trouble hearing you. Can you turn up your mic or something or get closer?
Working on it.
Yeah, hang on. He's working on it.
Oh, okay. I couldn't hear him.
Well, you caught me napping. Okay, can you hear me okay now?
About the same.
How about now?
That's better. There you go.
Okay, I had about 3 comments and a question for Brent.
Well, go ahead. I don't know. I guess he's still here, but...
That's okay. I've been hanging on a while.
yeah, that was over 10 minutes, that call. That's a little long. It's tough. That's why we don't like to discuss cases in detail.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, Brent is here, so go ahead, Fred.
Okay, well, apparently Obama, 8 years ago, made some kind of a treaty with the United Nations where the State Department and immigration was going to be handled by the UN. And Trump pulled us out of that today, I believe. That was one comment, and a question for Brett leaves with that. It's like, how can the President of the United States make a treaty without Congress?
Because he's Obama. I'm sorry.
Anyway, yeah, the next one was the sanctuary city laws. Now, this is a real interesting question, and I think Brent needs to answer on this one. Because right now we have a problem with these sanctuary cities not obeying federal law. Now, that's a beautiful thing if you think about it. It means that any city or state can refuse to pay federal income tax, can kick the damn military out of their state. They can tell the federal government to go fly a kite. And now the federal government is taking these laws and they're trying to put through the budget to where anyone who violates a federal law, especially immigration, they can take away the funding, but also they're looking at imprisoning politicians and political leaders like a sheriff for not following federal law. That's the key note there. And then the third one was Trump is going to release the names of the 256 people who used federal money to hide and cover up their whatever they did to seal the cases. Do you know about that? You know, the Congress was doing things and they were using federal dollars to pay the people off and...
Yeah, I think the only reason he would not release that is if there's an investigation going on right now, and he may not want to tip his hand.
Well, Trump is going to release those names, is what I've understood, but I don't know when.
I don't know. There's a lot of stuff going on, and it's hard to keep
track
of.
There is.
And you know, some of it is rumor, but you know, there's truth. There's shred of truth to it all. You know, and the trouble is you got the news media who are 99% owned by them, putting out misinformation. And you know, stupid people that don't know any better, they repeat that stuff.
Well, the part about the United Nations and this working with the State Department and the Immigration Department by mandating how many people are going to come here and from what area of the world they're going to come from is why we're being overrun by these Muslims and why they don't want to build the wall.
Well, he should go one step further and just get us out of the UN. That would be a long way to... You know.
Oh, I have a better idea. Yep, I have a better idea. Let's just take them all, round them up, put them in Gitmo, and start waterboarding them. Find out who's in it for what.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't know that they're going to do all the things that they say they're going to do because I don't think that they have They don't have the wherewithal to do it anymore, and the people are awake. I mean, can you imagine UN troops coming into cities and trying to arrest people or whatever?
Well, that's what Agenda 2030 is all about.
Well, just make sure they wear their blue helmets. They make nice targets. You know, look, I don't believe it's going to work. And especially not, you know, outside of the cities. You know, my goodness.
Well, their only hope is that the people don't have enough ammunition to fight them off.
That's never going to be the case, though.
Yeah.
Look, I have a 40 caliber pistol. They ordered 3 billion rounds of 40 calibers. I'll never run out. All I got to do is kill one of them and load up again.
Well, that's what they're doing in Venezuela right now. They're ambushing a cop to get his gun and ammo.
There you go. There's your ammo. You just solved the problem there, Fred.
Well, not really, because, you know, it's a misnomer. Anything can be a weapon.
That's right.
Any damn thing. I mean, I figure I'm about average, and my imagination can come up with all kinds of things that they don't want to talk about.
The thing between your ears is the biggest weapon you have, so you're right. I mean, once people come out and there's a line in the sand, that's going to be trouble for them, and they know that.
Well, yeah, the only problem then becomes how many can you take out with as little effort as possible.
Well, like you said, use your imagination.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, look, if everybody's against them, they have no place to go. You know, they eat dinner and there's antifreeze mixed in the dinner, you know. I mean, it's like, come on. The punch is poison, you know. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that they can do any kind of mass anything. You know, they work best when they work in darkness. They don't work good in light. And I don't believe they're going to do anything that's going to turn the light on them. And that would be a thing that would turn the light on them, that would make people come to the, you know, realization that we're under attack. And I mean, you don't want to get Americans under the idea that we're under attack. That's what they don't want to do. They really don't. As much as they act like an iron fist and stuff, they want to go come in, like, I think Krusner said, we'll take you over without firing a shot. That's their plan.
Well, that's what the UN is doing. Now, on InfoWars today, they covered a topic, I think it was on the David Knight show in the morning, where they were talking about Bitcoin and encryption money, encrypted money.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't believe, unless you saw it, they had McAfee on there talking about a wallet, a virtual wallet, how you can have money in your virtual wallet and the government can't control it. They don't know how much you've got. You can spend it on anything you want, any way you want. And they don't know.
Well, that's Bitcoin, but let me tell you something. The only reason the government is allowing that is because ultimately that's what they want. I believe that they allow Bitcoin because they plan on a digital currency, and they have even said, we'll let you do the same thing with anonymity. That's how they'll get it in. It won't last long because who's controlling the computers? They are.
Well,
I understand the whole Bitcoin thing, and I listened to that Jeff Berwick, the anarchist, whatever it is, and he's got a lot of good ideas, and he understands money in that, but I don't believe that they're going to let this Bitcoin. I think they like it because I think that's where they want to do away with the dollar, and they want it to be all digital. So they're going to design a system that looks a lot like Bitcoin. However, you know, it's the bait and switch. They're going to put the bait out there, the carrot on the stick, and pull it away. And they're talking about doing some kind of currency reset in January, which is, you know, right around the corner here. I don't know if it's going to work or not.
Is that Karen Hootis?
No, well, Karen Hootis keeps talking about them instituting money with gold threads in it and all this stuff. But, you know, she's lost so much credibility because she's made so many predictions that never happened. And she's a little kooky, I think. You know what I mean? She's not stable. And I don't see where she has any credibility because she's out there yelling and screaming about all this money they got and everything. Well, where is it? We don't see it. You know, and she talks about the generals and I don't know. I don't see anything. She reminds me of Benjamin Fulford. They're over there screaming, oh, arrests are coming, and this is happening, that's happening. And they're screaming the same story for how many years now? So, I mean, maybe there's a line of truth in there, but where does it actually fall? I don't know. You see, they have a problem. Because we are in debt and we cannot pay the bill, and they have to do some kind of a debt release, you know, and we're up against a brick wall. I mean, they kept Donald Trump is planning on releasing a whole bunch more money, like another quantitative easing. You can't keep dumping money on this thing, and because it's at the point where we can't make the payments now. So what do they do when you default? You know, what's the next step when you default?
Well, yeah. I think Donald Trump is the kind of guy that would print a couple $100 billion and pass it out to the people.
Well, yeah, but we're into the multi-trillions of dollars in the debt that we owe.
So what?
They're admitting the $22 trillion, and there's another 20-something trillion that in derivatives and stuff that they're not talking about. But you're right, because it's all, think about it. How can you owe money that isn't even in existence, because it's not in existence? You can't even pay this debt if you wanted to, because there's not enough money to pay it, which means that we can't owe it if it doesn't exist. How did you put that debt on me when you didn't have the dollars to begin with? That's the answer. It's the Shemitah. It's the big debt washing out. They're gonna have to wash it. You know, and one of the reasons that Donald Trump I think got very palsy wowsy with China is because we screwed China and gave them all our bad debt. And so they're heavily vested in the United States. That's why you see so many Chinese over here investing, because our money isn't going to be worth anything any place but in America here. There's going to be a period where our money is not going to be accepted anywhere, and the Chinese are going to come and try to spend all those American dollars they have, and they're going to be buying business and houses over here, and it's going to be the United States of China by the time they get done with us. But it's not their fault. It's our fault.
I don't think Trump's going to allow that. He's sealing up the UN.
Well, he's talking to them, so they're working something out. And that's a good thing. You know, and also, they don't want to come over here and bomb us or do anything, because it's like cutting their nose off to spite their face. They have so much of our debt in their hands, they have to work a deal, or they're going to lose everything.
Look, China is trying to take over the water around the Philippine Islands, and they're trying to get into the Philippines now.
Yeah, I don't know.
Have you ever been to the Philippines?
Yeah.
Have you?
What's that?
Have you ever been to the Philippines?
No, I've never been to the Philippines. I do have a sister-in-law that comes from Indonesia, and she's been through all there. Matter of fact, she's over there, and she can't get back now. They won't honor her visa. I don't know what's going on over there.
Yeah, well, the Philippines are they're tropical islands, but they're mountainous, and it's kind of like Japan, very mountainous. Their people are like villagers all over the place, living in many times dirt huts. Only in the cities do they have the modern conveniences. Even after World War II, there are still islands in the Philippines they have cannibals on.
Right.
So it's really a backward country in many respects. And China, I think, wants it.
Well, I don't know. I don't know who's going to stop them. You know, I mean, the only one who could stop China would be us. You know? And I don't know that we have the wherewithal to do that. I mean, why? Obviously, if China wants it, it's because there must be resources there. I don't know. And, you know, China's only, you know, they got a lot of backward people in China, too. China's a huge country, and it's not all developed. They're living in squander over there, too.
Well, China does not have a big navy. They don't have a very good air force. Quite frankly, they're landlocked. They're going to have to march on the country they're going to seize. It's going to be like whatever way they can march. That's where their strength is in massive numbers of people they can press into service. They might have some technology, but I guarantee you they don't have a big navy or a giant air force.
Yeah. But they're also a nuclear power, so who knows? You know,
yeah,
I don't know.
Right. Well, Russia and China both need a large standing army, because they're at each other's back door.
Right.
That's something that America doesn't look at very often. But if I had, you know, 10 billion Chinese sitting there at my back door, I'd damn sure have an army, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, he's not stupid. He understands that.
The same thing with China. If you had the Red Army lined up against you, you know, they built a great wall. They're not going to let them come in.
Well, maybe that's the plan, to get China and America fighting so then Russia will prevail, or vice versa.
It's nationalism. The United Nations is trying to destroy nationalism. That's what they're doing throughout Europe right now. They're making the whole of Europe one giant brown community so they can walk in and take them over.
Well,
they want to do the same thing to America. That's why the Chinese have our Panama Canal.
Well, I don't know what the answer is. People have to wake up, that's all. If people wake up, it won't happen.
Uh-huh. Well, is Brent still online?
Yeah, he is. What's your question?
Oh, well, I wanted to get his take on this stuff about Obama dealing with the United Nations.
Oh, the treaty thing, right.
Yeah, about making a treaty with them to where they run
our state. Without Congress's permission. Well, he said that when he was in there. He said, I'll just do it myself. I'll pick up my pen and do it. Remember when he said that?
Well, yeah, but he's doing that with immigration, where they're flooding our country with these Muslims. And that's also part of what's going on in Oregon and in Nevada with the Bureau of Land Management, where they're assuming that everything belongs to America. And that's where McCain was putting in those solar farm, and the Bundys were part of the last people who wouldn't leave.
Yeah, that was, what was that congressman's name, that his son?
McCain.
Not McCain, no.
Flake?
Oh, my, I'm drawing a blank on it. But
yeah, well, anyway, the same thing happened with the people in Oregon, as they had this Democratic politicians put in this law that they could do insider trading, and they started a uranium company, and they 300 different companies to do mining, and they were after the gold rights and all of that, and that's part of what's going on with Oregon. The same thing.
Yeah, Harry Reid was the one with the son that was doing the solar deal with China.
I think Harry Reid was the guy that was working in the Crimea, and he had some kind of a sweetheart deal with some kind of deal with oil.
Well, he was thick as thieves, him and his son, with this land over there in Nevada and the Bundys. He was the one that sent word to go after them. He's out of Congress now, I understand. He left.
Well, I don't know, but, you know, when these people get out of office, their crimes go with them. We should some way be able to grab them by the scruff of the neck and hold them accountable.
Well, they have a lot of evidence on him, so don't be surprised if he's not in one of those indictments. So we'll see. You know, and I think what Donald Trump is doing is he's taking the bottom out before he goes to the top.
I don't know what he's doing. I've been cursing Sessions, but maybe we're going to have to thank him. I don't know. I don't know whether he's sitting back and building up evidence to go take his sledgehammer out and crunch them all, or if he's just going to...
You know, they had what's his name on, showing that session was all wrapped up in this uranium run thing with Clinton. So I don't know. Everything's messed up. But anyway, we're 20 minutes down the road here, so.
Yeah, is Brent there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm here. Hang on a minute.
Yeah, that's him there. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I got it.
There he is.
Yes, Brent, the questions I had for you were, Obama, when about 8 years ago, grabbed his pen and he decided to take the United Nations and let them dictate policy to our State Department and immigration, flood us with immigration. and he sold out our Bureau of Land Management and all of that to these globalists so that they could sit there and steal American property. And that's what all this stuff is about, the Bundys and all of it.
Yeah.
Is the United Nations. Now, how can Obama do anything like that? Where is the treaty where he has any kind of power to do that?
Well, number one, he doesn't need a treaty to have power to do anything. No, the presidents do. Presidents don't even need law. They don't need a constitution. All they need is a military and a pile of bureaucrats that will do what he tells them to do, and he has power. That's what more normally happens. Of course, people are so woefully ignorant, and all are to a great degree, don't get me wrong, for ignorant, but some worse than others, some don't. The difference between a state constitution and the Constitution of the United States, I'm not excited. They don't know whether a man's running for U.S. Congress or state legislature, and if you told them, they wouldn't know the difference. How do I know? Because I ran for Congress a couple of times, and I found out people didn't understand the difference. When you walk out down the street and you see them sitting on the front porch, you holler at them and give them a flyer, and they ask, now, what is this, state or federal? What's the difference? They wouldn't know the difference either. Now, what's the difference between a Republican and a Democrat? I'm not exaggerating. Those are the kind of things people ask, and they ask it a lot. So you're asking about the BLM. They have power. The question is, do they have authority? There's a difference between authority and power. Authority is the right, the jurisdiction to do a thing, the right to act respecting a given matter. But power is just whether you have the raw force to pull it off. And you do it. Can you do it? Speaking of the BLM, I want to drop a footnote about them. Years ago, time flies so fast, all of a sudden you're just an older guy. But years ago, I was in the mining business out west, and we were on federal land. And the BLM, well, we're the ones managing this land. It had to do with mining claims and things like that. And the Bureau of Land Management, it didn't think about it. You just knew they didn't carry guns. You couldn't hurt anybody that way. There was no need for such things. And there still isn't, by the way. And we'd see them come around. We'd talk to them sometimes. Sometimes we wouldn't. But now, these same people that by law were not allowed to carry a fire rod are now, by law, apparently they say, are required to carry a gun and are armed and not only that, dangerous, untrained, ignorant, don't have a clue what they're doing. You never know. It's like dealing with a young Marine just out of boot camp. He wants to shoot his gun. He's very dangerous. He might hurt somebody. And by the way, sometimes those fellows do hurt somebody. I can tell you stories about that. But that's the way these BLM agents are. They're just thugs with guns. You know, somebody called federal agents, CIA agents, jackbooted thugs back when Bush was president. Well, he liked to hit the ceiling. He thought that was just despicable, anybody to refer to our elected employees that way. Well, no, that's not despicable. Those folks are nothing but thugs. And we don't need them. We don't need the FBI. Never did need them. Why do we have them? Because some weirdo by the name of, what was that guy's name? They said he was sexually compromised and didn't know the difference between man and woman. He was in charge when I was a young fella. From the 1930s, he's the one that founded the FBI. We didn't have the FBI. You know, we didn't even have federal prisons when the FBI was founded. Well, they built one. The first one they ever built of any note was that one in Alcatraz. Never did fill that thing up. Never got enough prisoners to fill it up. Then they just kind of dropped it by the wayside. Then began building a lot fancier ones, and now we're up to at least 5,500 criminal statutes. And for doing things that the Constitution never had in its contemplation, the writers never had, we're off the charts. We're so far gone now as a nation that I wonder, and people that I didn't think were wondering, and people I didn't think would ever try to leave the country, crying out loud. Well, is that the thing to do? A lot of people have done it. Are we kidding? From America, South America, and the thing's gotten out of hand, but there is a difference between authority and power. We'll come back to that. Maybe somebody will remember that. It's not a small difference. It's a big difference. And the ability to distinguish, you always say, oh, that's simple, Brent. Well, it may be simple, but it's not done often. For example, the great battle over the power of the jury that's been going on for centuries, still going on. Do they have the power or the right? That's the way the question has been framed for the last 200 years. Does the jury have the power or do they have the right to disregard the law? Important question, because there's a difference between power and right. Did Hitler have right to do it, or did he have power? And somebody said to me one time, well, the national legislature gave him the right, the jurisdiction, gave him the authority. There's another synonym, right, authority, jurisdiction, all three heavily overlapping synonyms. The German legislature gave him the authority, they said. I said, now, wait a minute. You're saying the German legislature gave Hitler authority to do it? Oh, yeah, you know, they did. He told me about the act and the name of it, and very famous act, and they handed it all over to him. I said, well, the way I get it, you cannot impart what you do not possess, and no man possesses the authority to do wrong. No man. Did the German legislature have the authority to do all those ugly things? My wife one time took care of a fellow in the hospital. This has been 4 years ago. And he was a Dutchman. And the Nazis had taken him, and they thought they'd use him to try to find out how much capacity a man's lungs would take before they would begin to explode. So they'd blow him up there until his alveoli started to burst, and then they'd stop the pressure, and they'd take measurements and write it all down. Well, that was a long time ago. He was dying of emphysema. That's what one way to get emphysema is to pump your lungs up with pressure to your alveoli. Well, you're saying the German legislature gave Hitler the right to order those kind of things to be done? I talked to another fellow, his uncle. He said he always wondered why he didn't have any children. And he just said, I found out recently, my mother finally told me the Nazis had castrated him when he was a little boy. Why? Well, he didn't make good enough grades in third grade. Didn't make good enough grades. They didn't work in their gene pool, so they just had the boy castrated. Yeah. Did anybody have authority to do that? The right? The jurisdiction? Oh, yeah, the German legislature gave it to Hitler. He could order things like that. Does any man have the right to do wrong? Can you impart, could the German legislature have given a right to do wrong to another man? The answer is no. Why? Because they never had that right to start with. Went to a thing not many years ago. It was a Tea Party meeting. It was in 2010. And they said, hey, bring your books. The lady that put the thing on said, bring your books. Bring them down here and you can sell books. And we'll set you a table up. My daughter is a real handsome creature. She'll come down there and sell a lot of your books. And her daughter was, the whole family. She had two or three daughters, all of them. And she came down and was helping me. And she was standing at the table there and they put on a little music. They had a band up front, and the moderator got up and said, before we start, Brent Winters is going to say a few words. I thought, well, I'm prepared to say any words. But being the way things were, and the crowd was looking at me, and she pointed to me, I ran up on the platform. I didn't know what to say. I was hoping by the time I got up there, I'd think of something to say. Well, just that day, the Congress of the United States had voted not to audit the Fed. Ron Paul was pushing that back then, remember? He was trying to push it through in the Congress. And I brought that point up, and I said this, and I'll say it here again today. I think it's a good way to look at things. If you see government doing something that you don't think is right, just ask yourself this question. If I or my friend, if the world government and me and my friends decided to do what the government, right? And if your answer is no, then government probably doesn't have the right to do it either. Why? Because government has no authority that we, the people of the United States, has not given them. And if we don't have authority to do something like that, or we can't imagine ourselves doing something like that, if there was no government, then chances are they don't have authority to do that either. Well, something we don't have. You cannot impart what you do not possess. if you don't have authority, you can't give it to somebody else. That's something to think about, I suppose. Well, back to you, Gerard or John.
Hey, thanks for that, Brett. All right. Thank you. Okay, Fred, I'll move on to Crystal if you're done. It's getting late here.
Okay, I'm muting out. Thank you.
Okay, yeah.
Hello?
Hey, Crystal, how you doing?
Okay. They came back at me again. When I put all my paperwork in, it was supposed to be for February 18th, 2018. They turned around, and the trustee, they wanted to move it up, so they wanted everything done by the 30th. So they could discharge and take my house for, you know. So what I did, I objected and put it all in, and I have to go to court tomorrow. And this is what they did. I didn't even get a notice or nothing from the court. It just so happened I had called to find out, you know, when was the next thing. They go, oh, it's going to be tomorrow. I said, tomorrow. So I got everything. I put all my paperwork in, and they have to answer all the questions tomorrow. So I did the objection, and I can sit there and go there, and I'm going to ask for the, you know, the note, the proof of claim, and the questions I get from the National Liberty Alliance. I put everything together, and then the exhibits, and also I put the paperwork of MERS. I sent John. I said the National Liberty Alliance, the package. Also, there was a check in there last week. Did they get that?
I don't know. I didn't get a chance.
Okay, tell them I put, you know, because I was trying to get everything.
I did get your message that it was in the packet.
Right, exactly. Okay.
Yeah.
And so,
I'll be honest with you. I talked to him, and I forgot to ask him about it, but.
Yeah, tell them to please make sure, because I put it in the envelope, and I was like, oh, man, I thought I put it in the envelope.
You know,
okay.
It seems like they're in a hurry, Crystal. Even that other woman, everybody's in a hurry. I think that they feel the winds of change, and they're trying to get the last bit that they can get out of everybody, because they're not sure how much time they have left. That's my feeling. Why are they pushing
well,
the hearing? Look, they didn't even tell you were going to have a hearing. If you didn't call, you wouldn't know. And
I would have known, exactly.
They don't
and
want you there because every time you put papers in, they have to answer it. So they want to do something that you don't know about and you miss. That's their game.
Yes, exactly.
You're making a record in the court, and that's what they don't want. Because ultimately, mm-hmm. if we're cleaning the swamp out, eventually they're going to get to those people, and they're going to say, what did you do here? So somebody over there is trying to make all their money now and get the heck out while they can. I think you have to be very much on your toes so that you can make sure you catch everything that they're doing and answer everything, because they're obligated to answer you back.
Exactly. And you know what I'm going to do, because I'm going to also amend this with on my deed. I'm going to file it on my deed at the town. So everything I do, I sit there and I file everything. Even when I gave myself the light, she goes, you've got wife use? Yes. I put everything on my teeth, you know.
Did you ever make your place a homestead? Did you ever do the Homestead Act?
I'm not sure. What is the Homestead
Act? Well, you declare it as a homestead. That's where you live. That's your place for living in that. And they can't take it for any other debts under the Homestead Act. But I don't
okay,
know.
That's just, also like life use.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I put on there, because I did that for my mother and quite a few others. You know.
Yeah, you just file it with the clerk. It's a very easy process.
It's called, you said Homestead Act?
Yeah, look it up. As a matter of fact, the clerk should have the paperwork that you fill out. You just fill in the blanks, like. Now, that, I think, is designed, I don't know that it's designed for mortgages, but it's designed for, they can't take your house for debts, for any other debts. They can't make you sell your house to pay a debt.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, they cleared all my debt from Chapter 7, you know?
Yeah, so now they're trying to come back after the house.
Well, no, everything was cleared, right? Now they got some other attorneys. All righty. So what I did, I put all their names in it. All righty. And because the attorneys are the debt collectors. And one other thing I learned, too. What was it? Oh, God, it was so important.
Look at the it's important.
The attorneys, like tomorrow when they go.
Yeah.
Mr. GE has to be there. Then they put another person. I put the CEO of Mr. The GE. Now they said no. They put the assistant vice president. So I'm going to write, well, is he there? And then the attorney will speak, but they're the third party. So all these things I'm going to object to, you know, because, and I want to see the legal contract. When in blue ink, the wet contract in blue ink, when did I take out a contract with you? Yeah. So, two other people said, I guess, I forgot who I was talking to, even in New Jersey, a young lady, and she said, you just keep on saying objection, objection, because they're not going to be there. They have no proof. And of course, the court stenographer, they have to record everything that's going on. You know?
Yeah.
And so this, and the good thing, this is the federal court I'm going to tomorrow.
Right.
And see, this federal judge, she was, oh my God, she was going off on those attorneys the last time I was there because they were doing all this other stuff. You know? And when they, and I finish, I'm going to ask her, could you please, I would like this case to be totally dismissed or discharged. Does
you know,
that sound okay?
It does. I you'll have to see how you make out. It sounds like a good idea. You know what I mean? And
mm-hmm.
you're in front of a federal judge now, right?
Yes.
So that's good.
That's where I'm going tomorrow, yes.
Is your name on the deed?
Yes.
Because they always, you know, there's that thing about accepting the deed. They like to leave that space open so that they can put their name in there when they take
it. Well, see, you know, and let me tell you what's happening here, too. All the homes that they've been putting in foreclosure, okay, because they're perpetrating foreclosure because we don't have too many sheriffs in our state. What they are doing, like the house across the street from me, and that poor, was awful. She ended up with an aneurysm and ended up dying. Because of all the stress, I come at the end of the time, don't move, don't move. Do you know that house is still vacant? And what they've been doing to all these illegal foreclosures now, they put on all the properties abandonment. So now that the house, the city takes it over. No one, like all the people I come and tell them, I said, your name is still on the deed. Nobody's changing the deeds now. You know, because it goes to the probate judge, or, you know, and as I said, the name is still on it. And then they just wait, and then they say, abandonment.
Well, it's another game they're playing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know over here they don't have any trouble converting a deed. Like, if you owe taxes or anything, right away the county converts the deed into their name. So now it's their property. And then they evict you like you're a scofflaw tenant. Like you're the tenant and you owe them money. And that's the paperwork.
Yeah.
They
what state do you live in? Is that
What's
New
that?
York? What
yeah.
state are you in?
In New York.
New York.
They're terrible.
Yeah. But you know what was that guy's name? His name was Shelton Silver.
Sheldon Silver, what a snake.
Okay, but, you know, he's the part of the 43 years ago, he was the one who was a part of that Ponzi scheme on change of the deeds and mortgages You know what I'm saying?
Oh, and, yeah, he was the one, huh?
Yes, it was. And that's why he's in jail now. You know, I stay abreast on all this stuff. Also, like, for example, in our state, you know, ours is the third smallest state in the United States. Who's smallest? Rhode Island's first, Delaware second, Connecticut third. We have over 30,000 attorneys. Can you imagine in this little small state? So there's 169 cities and towns in the state of Connecticut. That's 177 attorneys. Each one of these nuts are worth close to $1 billion a year. So Connecticut's the new Hollywood, and they're taking, they want to take everyone's property. And the sad thing of it is the next reevaluation that they have in the United States, everybody will end up losing their homes because the cost of living goes up, but not our salaries, you know? And it's just like, it's called the gated communities.
Yeah.
The gated communities, people will sell their homes, you know, saying, okay, well, I don't want to take care of all this property, and say, well, this is a good investment. I'll sell my home for $300,000 or $400,000, I'll move in the gated community. Well, when you sit there and sell your property in these gated communities, which most of them are owned by the corporates, attorneys, or whatever, when something happens or if you want to move out, you don't get nothing back.
Right.
And this is another big Ponzi scheme because you're paying all this money for this dwelling, but the secret behind this is that you never own the land. You know? So it's just like if you should pass on and you say, I want to leave this to my family. Well, if your family member who you left it to is not 55 years of age or making a certain income, nobody gets nothing. It goes right back to the corporate. And this is another big thing. So, you know, people be careful when you buy or what have you.
Well, look at...
And that's why... I'm sorry?
They figured out how to get things many different ways. Even if they got to raise the taxes and take it away from you, it's the same difference. You don't own it. They take it. They convert
it. Yeah, well, they need... And what they need to come back with for everybody, as a matter of fact, because even like for my pension and this and that, you know, they've been ripping us off on that. So I contacted our representatives and what have you. And so, oh, they're jumping through the hoops now. They're all trying to help me on this and that, you know, because of the pensions and all that. So they're acting very kind, you know. And, they said, because, like, even with my IRS and stuff like that, they said it was too late for them. So they're keeping my money. I said, who's keeping my money? Because the money is your bonus. It goes back, you know. So, and, but it's just like you do. You have to stay abreast on everything.
So you're in court tomorrow, Crystal?
Yeah, it's at 12.
You got anybody to go with you?
Yeah, I put it out there. And hopefully I'll have about maybe 5 or 6 people.
Well, good luck anyway. I God bless you. You know, you're very tenacious, and that's the one way you'll beat them is just by hanging in there because they're not used to that. So
yeah, but I was so shocked. It was like I could not believe because I said I didn't hear nothing. So I called down there, and I said, "Oh, by the way," and they said, "Well, you have a court date tomorrow." I said, "What?"
Yeah.
You
see,
know,
God was on your side, see?
Yes, Jehovah is always, yeah. You know, and I feel fine. You know, I read my Bible, I've been praying, and just, you know, doing, you plant good seed, you get good growth.
Right.
You know, and I've been reading Zephariah, Habakkuk, oh my God, about the judge, the legal, and all this other stuff, you know.
Right.
In Psalm 37, and I always go into court with my Bible.
Good for you. Good. Well, let us know how you make out. Give me a call. Leave me a message if I don't pick up. I want to know what happens. Anyway, I want to get Felicia. We only got a few minutes left, so.
Okay, who's this, Gerard?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Thank you. You have a good night.
You too.
All right.
Bye. Yeah. Okay. Felicia, I bet you didn't think...
Hello, gentlemen. How are you guys tonight?
Good. How are you doing?
Awesome. I have a question, a couple of questions. One, can I use a file on demand to reopen my illegal foreclosure case? And I also want to know if I can use that same file on demand to file my papers from the grand jury to as a copy on the fake deed that Fannie Mae and this guy filed with nobody's name on the back of it.
Well, you can always use the file on demand because that just, you know, tells them that they better not take your papers out. You know, they're going to see you coming. They don't want to file anything from you, I'm sure. They know who you are, right?
They do.
So, I mean, I would use the file on demand no matter what. Now, you know, you're not in the federal court yet, are you?
It's been filed. My paperwork and my affidavit has been filed with the grand jury, and they still put me at my house, and I'm, like, homeless and stuff.
Yeah, but you didn't move the case into the federal court yet, right? Into the
not the local federal court, because from my understanding that it was already in federal court and that Judge Kahn was just recently indicted.
Oh, what do you mean? You're in the court where Judge Kahn is?
Yes.
Oh my goodness. But where's your property at?
Florida.
In Florida.
Yes, sir.
So it should be filed in a district down there next to you, whatever the Florida district is. I mean, you can file it in any federal court. I mean, we still haven't, they're still taking our paperwork and putting it on the docket, even though they claim that the case is closed. And that's something that we're addressing right now, but that could be a while before anything happens there. I mean, it seems to me that you should have a case filed in the federal court on your own besides whatever paperwork you filed with NLA. I mean, we're basically telling him he's in bad behavior, but, you know, that doesn't give you a docket number in the federal court yourself.
Yes, sir.
Of course, you know, they want $400 to file it there. That's the problem. You know, unless you go in pop poor. You know, when you're homeless, you certainly would probably qualify for that. You know.
For what?
You know, where they say you can't afford it, so they'll waive the $400 fee.
What did you call it?
I think they call it in pop poor. In
oh, okay.
You know, but I know I know Jim's got your paperwork, and we need to discuss what your next step is going to be. I mean, I don't know what we're going to do with Judge Kahn, but I don't see a instant. You know, you need to do something soon.
Right.
I don't know. You know, look, they're going to drag us around a little bit. They're not going to cave because we're going to go after the magistrate. I think what was his name? Kennedy or I don't remember, but
Stewart.
Stewart is the next guy because he should be. I don't care if Kahn is his boss. It doesn't matter. They got an oath of office, and he's came in and took over that case with no authority, and he saw the paperwork, and he should straighten him out, you know?
So don't use the file on demand in the local county court? Just
no, I'm not saying that. I would use the file on demand in whatever court you're going in, but the thing is, you know, you're not going to get the county court is going to do what the county court does. Unless you get in the federal court, they're not going to, you know, it's going to be hard because they're all in collusion and they're all stupid and they don't care.
Yeah, I know. So is the sheriff, and I informed him like months ahead of time when it was actually an open case before Kahn even closed it or so-called dismissed it. But, you know, my circumstances have changed and, you know, I'm not used to this. You know, and they stole my house, and the guy's just fixing my house up, and my neighbors came up to my job, told me they put in a new AC, they fixed the roof, they did this, they did that, and it's the same guy that put the notice on my door, the real estate guy, and his name is the one that's on the deed, a special need at that.
No kidding.
No, I'm serious. Like, the, at the bottom of the deed, there's, like, somebody whited out the name. So I got a copy of the so-called new deed, and I have my original deed, and I have all the police officers' names and badge numbers that I actually videotaped. And one actually called me and told me to unlock the front door, that they was here to, you know, turn over the house. And I was like, I'm not there. And I rode by and I videotaped them all. And they were really pissed.
Yeah. Well, you know what? They're going to do whatever they want to do until they get a summons into the court.
Yes, sir. I mean, it's like I want to do both. I want to do it on a local level and on a federal level. Because, you know, they, especially the police officers here, I mean, I, like, know them. And to see them actually at my front door, and they previously knew what my circumstances was, to actually see them plying open my door with a crowbar.
You file that case in the federal court for cause, and you file it against every one of those officers. You're doing it on the law. The state court's not going to give you remedy. It has to come out of the federal court because it's a constitutional issue under color of law. And what you need to do is you need to get one of those U.S. codes and include it in the case, and there's plenty of them, and they did plenty of violations, and then each one of them will get a summons to court. That's when they get upset. And that real estate agent should be the top of the list. He should be on there. But we should talk
about this. The sheriff, definitely. The sheriff, definitely. Because I informed them back in June, you know, way before ahead of time, and actually went and spoke to them. And it was like there was nothing. They didn't even give me a case number that they would speak to me. So.
Yeah. Well, you see, the trouble is you got to be able to file that paperwork yourself, but you're going to have to study a little bit. It's difficult. We can't really do that for you. But I think if you really buckle down and look at, and we could actually, you know, give you a little bit of guidance that you could probably.
Because I need guidance because I don't understand. I'm still learning. And my civics course, I can't download the Flash Player to even get through that.
Oh, yeah.
That's always something.
Yeah. Well, if you got an older computer, I'm having the same problem with all these changes they want. You know, all of a sudden they don't take Java and this and that. They're always making changes to stymie us.
Yeah.
So.
But I don't want to hold you up. I just wanted to ask that question. So.
Yeah. Well, you're good. Anyway, we're going to close out now. We're after 12. But keep in contact with Jim. We're discussing some other strategies here in the federal court, and we'll talk to you about that off of this show, okay?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for your time.
Okay. You have a wonderful night. God bless you, and you're in our prayers here.
God bless you, and thank you very much.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Okay. It's 12:02. I'm going to sign off, and thank you, everybody, for showing up, and we'll see you here at same time, same station next week. Have a good night. God bless everybody.